Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge, with Squidge. Let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
Hello and welcome back to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective Podcast, the rugby podcast that is trying to work out what a birthday is if it's 8 years before you're actually born, because this game took place on my birthday, but 8 years before I was born.
Happy minus eighth birthday, Robbie Owen.
Thank you. At the time, I was just like a collection of particles floating around Swansea somewhere, hoping to one day become a sperm.
Yeah,
so that's my memory of the game. Yeah. I'm joined as ever by Will Owen. How are you doing?
All right. Yeah. I mean, I'm feeling pretty good. And you sound particularly chirpy as well today, Robbie.
Yeah, well, it's all for the sheer joy of finally being joined by the one. I suppose you're not the one and only, are you? As you've very much found out this week.
One of very many.
One of the Paul Williamses. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you, gentlemen? I'm so glad to finally be on.
Yeah.
And thank you for inviting me.
It's a delight to have you, Paul.
We tried, like, I think I first asked you before we started doing the podcast. Like,
yeah.
I think I first asked you, like, to be on one of the first kind of five episodes or something.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's just taken until now for the stars to align and everything to kind of fall into
here
place.
I tell you, and now I'll drag you down to my depths. Overuse of metaphor.
I think it's probably deliberate that you've happened to end up on basically one of the best games we'll ever cover on this podcast. So fair play to you, Paul. Yeah.
Brilliant game. And it was, do you know, that game is essentially the, you guys weren't born, but it's that I became rugby conscious in about 1987.
Right,
so I was born in 77.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the first pro rugby I can remember.
Right.
But okay. It wasn't pro, but I mean top level.
Yeah.
So I'd be taking the Schweppes Cup finals, stuff like that, Swansea and Neath. My dad used to take me and my grandfather. But that's just about the first stuff I can remember watching on TV.
Right.
Yeah.
So what is kind of your, to kind of delve more into that, what is kind of like your memory of all of that? You know, how do you remember like enjoying it? What kind of hooked you onto it in that respect?
The big memory is Paul Thorburn's kick, right? Mm-hmm. In the third, fourth playoff. And I remember my dad getting me up to watch it. It must have been like 4 a.m. And I remember feeling, you know, really grown up.
Yeah.
Right? And it's the first time my dad almost sort of went, right, come on, son. You can get up now before you should be. Like, all right, I'll come down and watch it. Yeah, it's that World Cup is like my first proper memory. And just the players, you know, names like Campese from the game we've watched, they are the first names I can really remember, you know, like David Campese. That stayed with me forever, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, I bet your mum was gutted when he first words.
I'll tell you what, my mother is more into rugby than my dad, believe it or not.
Oh,
oh my God. My mother, you can have her on next.
We'd love to.
Right? I'm game. And she, I'm game
if
with
you
that.
Think I talk a lot, right? She does not stop. It's incessant, right? I can't get a word in. So yeah, get her on next. She'll love it.
I want to ask, like, who does she think should be the Welsh 10 or something? But it's fairly settled at the minute. You know, it was this sort of...
That's the worry, though, isn't it?
Does she have any particularly strong opinions?
She does. She's, she'll never look past Tommy Bowe in any regard.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is
very similar to our mother.
Yeah. Tommy Bowe, she, when he was in Swansea playing down the Osprey, she used to, is bother the right word? Assault's probably a near description. Just go up. You know, she sort of loves him as a player and fancies him. She always talks to him. But
don't
she's really into it, right? She's 74, 75.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'm involved in it a little bit, so I tell a little bit to Bob. But she will watch top 14 games I haven't even watched, right? She said, oh, yeah, there was
that's brilliant.
Weekend I watched Bordeaux. Oh, Christ, I didn't even watch Bordeaux. Yeah, she's into it. She's retired now. She'll watch anything.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's great. That's really good to hear.
She's finally got time for those super rugby games on Friday
Honestly,
mornings.
She's probably watching Pro D2 and don't even tell me.
Like one day she's just going to come out about that, come clean about that. I actually watch Pro D2 is my favourite league.
Yeah, or she'll give me the top 10 Georgian props. You know, playing in French rugby. Like, oh, thanks, mammy. I'll do a column on that now.
You've got a ghostwriter that we're now learning about, Paul.
Exactly. I mention her all the time. One in six podcasts, I mention my mother. God, love her.
Big question, though, right? How did your mum feel about Rory Best? Because the thing I've learned over the last 10 years is mums all love Rory Best. It's a universal fact.
He's got that appeal, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's got that kind of clearly a good man, would make a great uncle.
Yes, kind of, and he'd rescue babies from burning houses. Yes. But he's like a front row forward who isn't aggressively violent.
Yeah.
Like, whereas some of the others, I won't mention them, they might rescue that baby and then potentially choke that baby. Right?
Yeah.
If given the wrong circumstances.
Accidentally or on purpose.
Yeah, or just elbow drop it and, whatever. But Rory, he's got that nice warm feeling, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's got the look of one of those village church bell gents.
Yes, he has,
hasn't he? That warmth and security. Yeah, yeah.
So, before, I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast or anything before. Before I was doing all of this, before I was doing any of the Squid Rugby stuff, before I made the
before
video,
you took the world by storm, can I say?
Whatever that. Thank you. That's Jesus. Before people being far too kind to me about making some silly videos.
Everyone was just bullying you instead. Yes,
I tell you what. In all seriousness, there's a world before rugby content. Squidge, you're almost like the sort of AD.
I'm really not.
So that would be, what would that be? Before BS. That's
BS,
not that.
BS,
that's
that
awful.
Is
you don't want it to be that.
It is BS.
But before we, Squidge.
Hang on.
Could not be more perfect.
Can we get Paul on every week, please?
Yeah.
There is. Before that, rugby content was, what it was, and it was traditional even. And then you've taken it forward a lot, man. You've got a lot to be proud of, a pair of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. That's really very nice. Before I started this,
my boss used to be Rory Best's wife's cousin.
Jesus.
And so she one day just said to me, oh, Robbie, you like rugby, don't you? And I was like, yeah. She's like, have you ever heard of a player called Rory Best?
Yeah, once or twice.
Yeah, he's the island captain. And she went I just found out. So my cousin's husband, it was we're just over Christmas. I was just chatting to him. I've always just known him as Rory, and I only just found out he's a rugby player. And it turns out he's Rory Best.
Yeah, he's one of the best rugby players on the planet, mate. Yeah. That's who he is.
But for a time, he was one of the best soccerers in the world. He really
had. Oh, I love Rory Best.
18 months, that's quite a long time in Test.
I am basically a mum with how much I love Rory Best.
Yeah, I know. He really is up, especially. I don't know. It's tricky, though, isn't it? Because you always tend to, when you measure those boys at the top, top level, it always comes down to that lion stuff.
Yeah.
Because you end up filtering all the way to the top. Oh, God, did they really do it at that level? But
the thing I loved about Rory Best, though, is he was a great lion for how seriously he took being a second teamer. He took being a midweek teamer.
Great midweek captain.
He will always kind of go down in my mind as a great lion for the fact that even though he wasn't making the test team, he consistently captained that midweek team and did a great job and took it very seriously and kind of took young players under his wing and so on.
That's it. And people talk about that like it's a bad thing because he was a world-class player who had the ability to be a test lion, obviously. Mm. But the fact that he was still playing very well, just only well enough to be the midweek captain and a brilliant one at that, pretty goddamn commendable.
I know. Think of that level just to be...
Yeah.
Do you know, I always mention
1%
this. 1% off, right? That's like just not being in the SAS, right? And that means you don't want to mess with those lads.
Yeah.
You know, where I come, where you guys and we come from in South Wales, there's a rugby club every mile and a half.
Yeah.
Quite literally, right? Where I live, maybe every 2 miles. You've got Gowton, you've got Bonarla, you've got Dunford, you've got Penclouth. And then a lot of those filter through. I don't know anyone, right? I'm 45. None of my friends or any direct acquaintances ever played full caps for Wales.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then you imagine that level where you're good enough to get through to be a British Lion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, then, oh, you're only a midweek Lion. Well, I tell you what.
You take it.
What, midweek Lion? What? You know, yeah. that's the pinnacle.
Phenomenal.
Like, I last year met someone who'd played Leicester Tigers Academy with Freddie Stewart and said, like, even at that level, he was completely dominant.
Yeah, I like, can imagine.
Those players that kind of go on to hit that standard are unplayable even at the highest possible youth levels, you know? And like,
yeah.
I know, Will, you played against a handful of like.
Yeah, I played against
like Paolo Adogwu.
Paolo Adogwu. Yeah. From Wasps, Jesus. And he was a handful. Let me tell you that much.
And like we played in a touch rugby tournament a couple of years ago, like before COVID.
Yes,
and we found out on the day that one of the teams we were against had two Loughborough Lightning players.
Oh my god!
And obviously, tell you what, they ripped us to fucking shreds.
We got battered.
Yeah, you will. Because they're a different level.
Yeah,
you know, and if you met, you know, someone like Freddie Stewart now, he's different level, even in the elite level.
Yeah.
He's gone straight in. I can't remember many fullbacks who take the ball down like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can't remember a fullback as good as him, as young as him.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because he's like, already not making mistakes.
Yeah.
Normally, this is your mistake two or three
seasons.
That's it.
Like, he's a world-class high ball merchant, which means that if people mark him a bit more heavily, then who cares? Because he carries the ball like, you know, a good number eight 10 years ago will have.
Yeah.
And he's so unbelievably strong that it just doesn't matter like how heavily people want to mark him. He's like, fantastic for Stewart.
Stuart Hogg and Lee Halfpenny were both extremely good at his age, right? But Halfpenny was extremely good as a winger, and Hogg was still making the odd error under the high ball defensively and stuff.
But it was a bit flashier.
Whereas Stewart isn't.
Yeah. No.
Like, it's at amazing.
All. Yeah.
No, not at all. No. I was just having a little daydream about Freddie Stewart then.
I was going to say, before we get onto the game that we're covering, I want to quickly bring in the fact that we've almost got you on a complete inopportune week here, Paul, because it's very, very topical, as Robbie alluded to earlier, that there are many, many Paul Williamses in the world, one of whom being the referee who had a perfectly fine game on the weekend.
He did.
You know, whatever. Yeah. But the other one, of course, we've talked about at length on this podcast, having done the 2011 series, that we have spent a series talking about a Paul Williams before in the former Samoa fullback.
Right, so now he's like the number one Paul Williams, as far as I'm concerned.
He
was a poor man, I tell you
he
what.
He was a great player. Yeah.
If he'd have played in a different, you know, he was a quality fullback. If he hadn't have got nudged out with that kind of AB scene, he'd have. But that was in that era where if you were a fullback playing for the All Blacks, you were just lining up in a car park.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, now is your chance to either confirm nor deny that you are that Paul Williams.
I'm not him. Okay. Sadly, I thought I was the third best Paul Williams involved in rugby. I think I'm down to about eighth now. There's an outside half from Neath, fullback from Ebervale, a couple who played rugby in or around Gloucester, elite level. And this is without all the amateurs, of which there'll be thousands of them.
Thousands.
So it's been a good kick in the eagle windpipe this week. It's been fantastic.
It did come up the other week on this podcast, actually, that the England fly-off, Peter Williams, the commentator accidentally called him Paul Williams.
There we go.
So it's kind of like they're just trying to dig you down further.
That's me down to ninth.
Have you been mixed up with the guy who wrote the songs for the Muppet movies much?
Yeah, quite often. Seriously? Yeah. So I've had a couple of... And there's also an Irish political journalist.
Oh, really?
Right. Who doesn't just do, you know, matters of admin and national governance. He deals with Irish mafia. Right. So he's got like threats on his head. I've had a couple of those.
Jesus Christ.
So I'll quite go off and get the odd. I'm not even going to say it on you. But things.
Jesus. They must clearly go on Twitter and see at the Paul Williams. That's the Paul Williams.
Got to be him. And I've got a face that people will want to punch. So as soon as they see my face, they just go, well, we'll either punch that or shoot that. And then, they're done then. And then they don't get to see all my overuse of metaphor and double line spacing. It's a real shame, really.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they just really hate double line spacing.
Yeah, they're just punctuation Nazis.
I am hearing you speak here, Paul. I am inserting them manually in my head as we go along. I'm punctuating your every sentence.
I know. Do you know, and I only started doing that because when phones came out, they were a lot smaller.
Mm.
And my day job, I'm a creative director of an advertising agency, so rugby's like my part-time job. And, you know, whenever you do ads, you space them so people can read them in chunks, which is why I started doing it. And then it became a thing.
It works for you, though, Paul. It's your niche.
Yeah.
And then it became a thing. And then, you know, you can never have too many things.
That's it. I mean, I've realised since getting into the whole rugby Twitter scene in the last couple of years, that if I double space something, I go, no, it's too much like Paul Williams. I can't do that. I can't be stealing his ways.
Stealing his brand.
Yeah. I'll be done for plagiarism. Like,
I know. Always be different. I always remember being told that by an old creative director. Whatever you do, be different.
Love it. Yeah. Love it.
And it sort of worked.
Yeah, got us all this far. It's somehow
correct. Hey,
it's got you on this podcast.
Correct. That's why I'm on here, exactly.
So, yeah, you mentioned, obviously, you have memories of this World Cup.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what you're kind of like, as someone that is obviously, as we all are, more used to modern rugby, how was going back to this World Cup from how many ever years ago?
Do you know what? I'm always a little bit confused by it because most of my rugby heroes, like the proper big ones, played in that era.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, people like Jeffy, Jonathan Davis, that was their kind of era, and people like Serge Blanco.
Mm.
And then it's tricky because when you listen to a certain age group of rugby fans now, say if they're over 60, they laud that era like it was the greatest time in history, which if you watch back, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm always torn when I watch it back because in some ways it's better, but in some ways it looks really, really amateur.
Yeah.
And the amount, you know, the amount of turnovers from possession, just dropping balls. I don't mean from lineouts. Just mean, you know, offloads. There's no one on each shoulder. There's no diamond sort of behind you. Mm. It's literally flung. So I'm always torn. But then after the 80 minutes, I always love it.
Mm.
And then,
yes.
So that's sort of where I am with it, you know?
I think that's been the fascinating thing about watching this whole tournament back is every game produces great highlight reels, but they're not necessarily entertaining to watch.
Yeah,
that's the thing. And when people look back, they only see the highlights.
Yeah.
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 And you look at the amount of like promising attacks where eventually the last pass is dropped or it's intercepted or something like that happens. And you realise like, oh no, there's 80 minutes worth of this. And you condense that down to 6 minutes. It looks amazing.
Yeah. It looks amazing. You know, there was a piece in there where just out of nowhere, a player would take a blindside option straight into touch.
Yes. Yeah. Run a little switch on a counter attack,
straight,
don't they? Yeah.
Like the switch option isn't there now in the 5 meter channel, and I'd argue it was never there.
Yeah, it's very,
we'll
very
run
funny.
A switch there, and we'll just run straight in a touch.
Yeah,
it's whereas phenomenal. Now you'd be dropped.
Yeah,
you know, if you were test wing or scrum half and went straight in a touch, that rather, you don't understand what's going on. You won't play again.
Stepping in a touch, kicking the ball out 1 yard in front of you.
Yeah. And the other big thing is how much ball is kicked.
Yeah. Mm.
So particularly in that game that we're going to talk about now, the first half in particular, all right, you know, it's a World Cup semi-final. That's a big thing. You probably are going to kick an awful lot of ball, but that isn't the rugby you're led to believe that was played all of the time.
That's it. Yeah.
You know, God, Campese, who is one of the best attacking wings from that period, probably the best, I'd say overall. Yeah. He probably kicked his first 5 touches from 6.
Yeah.
And Michael Leiner, who's a fantastic player, you'd expect the 10 to kick a lot. But there was an awful lot of kicking from midfield. I don't think we saw the outside backs for the first probably 25 minutes. You know, it's makes you realise that territory's always been key.
Yeah.
You know, territory.
Spot on.
No matter what else happens, especially with the lineouts back then. I mean, just like a Jesus Christ.
Complete lottery.
Pre-lifting. It's amazing. And that's why you kicked the touch, though.
Yeah.
Because it was just like a coin flip.
Yeah. It didn't matter if you ran out because you had 50 yards and get the ball back.
There's one point where I have it written down in the first half. And I know we'll get onto the teams and the game itself and everything, but like the point where I had written down that because Australia's kicking game was so great that I thought if there was lifted lineouts in here, would be all over them.
Yeah.
Totally. And especially with the size of those locks at the time, because they're about 14 stone.
Yeah.
But 6 foot 6, you could lift, you know, that's, you know, the locks of that age, they were light, you know, they weren't clear and out.
Yeah.
You know, the racks were cleaned out with feet then. You know, and that they just were.
Yeah. So should we look at the two teams?
Yeah, let's get in.
Because I think so, Australia pick largely the same team. I think it's just Troy Coker comes in at number 8 for the injured Jeff Miller. And otherwise, they pretty much stick as they are. Nick Farr-Jones recovers, meaning that Eddie Jones can rest easy that Brian Smith's left on the bench.
Yes. It's a team that sort of each player in that back line and the majority in that forward pack has come into form as the World Cup's gone on, I think.
Yeah.
So it's a really exciting team on paper. And you look at that and think, like, oh, that's a quality team, you know, with Papworth and Slack in the centres, the Burke, Grigg and Campese back three. It's a really strong and exciting team going to the semi-final.
And that they keep Campese at fullback as well, which was kind of controversial at the time. And there was a lot of talk in the kind of Australian press leading into this of how they basically didn't like how this Wallabies team was playing because they were kicking too much and they weren't running the ball constantly.
Right.
And they were kind of very controversial for that, for the fact that, you know, they were playing a far more conservative brand of rugby. And there was, in the lead up to this, there was one of the Australian papers described this as basically going to be a Five Nations game because Australia are basically an English or Scottish team in terms of how much
bloody good though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. God, that's so interesting.
Yeah. And so it kind of, it's a lovely bit of context as well for those first kind of 20 minutes where Australia are kicking a lot and do get really on top. But yeah, some of the, Paul, just like looking through that team, I suppose the pack are lesser known, but like that Australian backline is full of players who you kind of hear about in hushed tones.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, there are three or four in there who then went on to make it through to like 1995, 1996, yeah. 1999. You know, they went.
Yeah.
God, I remember Michael Leiner when he signed for Saracens.
Mm.
Right. So that's how long after this? 10. That's 10 seasons after this, probably.
Jeez, yeah.
I think, you know, him and Sal, 10 seasons, yes. 1996, I think, or 1996, 1997. And then Sal joined him. And that was almost the start of Saracens being that force that they then became.
Yeah.
Without salary caps. But they, you know, they were the two that convinced a lot of other people to show up. You know, if you've got those two, you know, God, I think Sal had 111 caps in the end.
Yeah.
Which, when you, when it's, you know, back in those days,
that's
you
insane. Know, that,
that's pre-November internationals.
Yeah.
That's one less fixture in the Six Nations or whatever you'd call it then.
Yeah. Well, I want to say Campo got 101 as well. So, like,
think of that.
That's insane in this day and age. Well, and it shows kind of the longevity of those players.
Yeah.
Seller was the first player to ever 100 caps. And he said on the occasion of his 100th cap that this game against Australia in 1987, was the best game he ever played in.
Was it really?
Which is something that he stood by ever since.
Yeah.
He thinks this was the best game he's ever played. Andrew Slack said the same thing. He felt this was the best game he ever played in. Michael Leiner said it was one of the best. So did David Campese.
That's so interesting.
Because I'm going to have to pick him out of the match later. Really good.
Yeah.
Simon Podovan, who I mentioned in the previous podcast, who has had all sorts of weird financial misgivings since his career ended, he said in that autobiography where he doesn't confess to it that he thinks this is maybe the best game of rugby ever played, and he played in it, so he's not biased at all.
good lad.
That's
like Norman Wisdom, right, being on Desert Island Discs, and when he could take in three of his records, he picked all of the songs written and sung by his good self.
That's very good.
Fair play.
Same thing as Francois Truffaut had to name his favourite films and he named three of his own in his top 10.
Good lad.
You're like, you know what? Respect it. Respect
it's all
it.
About the repeat fees.
What are your top two YouTube videos, Robbie?
Me?
Oh,
I'm putting Squidge on the spot.
Yeah. I would. I'm a really big fan of James Haskell running into the posts.
Okay.
And an even bigger fan of Toby Flood running into the posts.
Oh, so they're your top two. You're not picking one Squidge rugby video?
I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay. Just stay away from it.
Okay.
My favourite two are Jonah Lomu's highlights 1 and 2, and I'm not even joking.
I love it. I love it.
I watch them twice a month. Whenever I feel down, I just flick on his highlight reel.
Reminder, get Paul back on in 1995.
I'm a big fan of Jonah Lomu.
Should we look at a French team?
Sure, yeah.
Speaking of teams we're big fans of, it's absolutely fucking stacked, this team is. It's unbelievable. Like, and again, like, there's very few of these players I knew quite how good they were before watching this World Cup. But as I say, France have had a very easy ride so far in this tournament. But you look at that, you look at Serge Blanco, obviously one of the greatest fullbacks to ever play, and has shown all tournament how great he is. And it's great that Didier Cambero-Bero gets a start on the wing after having previously broken the record for most points scored in a game earlier in this tournament.
Being dropped.
Yeah, exactly. Because he usually plays fullback. So they just kind of thought like, oh yeah, well, you played basically the best game anybody's ever played at international level there. But we do have Serge Blanco. So on the bench you go, son. So it's good that he gets a start.
They also move Frank Menzel in from 12 to 10 in a classic French move to bring in Denis Charvet.
So French, isn't it?
Yeah. He's just like forced to move up. You know what? Was playing 12 all season, had been really settled into 12 playing for Racing that year. And then for the semi-final, they went, you know what? You're a 10 now again. Good luck.
My God.
Other thing I found out about Frank Menzel is he's become famous for wearing stripy scarves on French TV as a pundit.
Oh, wow.
So there you go.
Good lad.
It's kind of like his French scarves become iconic.
It's the trivia
Paul,
we love
to hear.
Fucking hell, that was a long time ago.
Sorry,
I'm all in tennis shorts now, in tennis tops. It's middle age. Yeah, but a little hub of that team were key in setting up that French rugby fashion label, of course. What the hell were they called? I've forgotten now. With a little pink bow tie. So they played from Stade. So Menel was key to that. And it was, So they were, that, and I think that French team there, they are the French team that my dad still lords and wants back. You know, the Sellars and the Chavez and those guys just slinging it around, and which we sort of are nearly back to, but just with probably a meatier pack. Weirdly.
I think that's it. I think that's where we're at now. We've now finally got another French team that's going to kind of replace them in the memory.
You're right. And do you know what, Squidge? I'll always remember you saying after I don't know how many under 20s championships there were, I remember you saying you watched this group of French youngsters, right? And they will challenge for the World Cup in their country. And I remember favouriting it and thinking, right, I'll keep a little eye on this. And I tell you what, you're not far away. You are not far away now.
That French under-20s team from, what was that, 2018, 19 maybe?
Yeah, it must have been 18, 19.
Unbelievable, where they had like Romain Untermac, Cameron Wauquiez, even like players like Louis Carbonell, who haven't quite cracked the national team, are phenomenal players.
Yes.
But what's
Carbonell? Is he fourth choice?
It's stupid, isn't it? Well done. Like, tough gig being stuck behind Romain Untermac and Mathieu Jalibert.
You're struggling.
How are you supposed to crack that team?
We were having this conversation the other day, just as we do, of like, oh, if you name your World 15 of players under 23. And we were kind of thinking for a while, like, oh, do you put Marcus Smith? I don't know.
Yeah,
and going back and forth on Garbizzi we were kind of talking about. And then we remembered Romain Untermac's 21.
He's a bit older than that, isn't he?
21.
Oh, is he 22?
I think he's 23 now, but he still fits the threshold.
He's 14, turns out. He's turned 23. He's 23, sorry. Okay. Still. He's still stupidly young.
Stupidly
young. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. That's like, George North. That's sort of like George North years.
Yeah.
You know, like when you measure dog years and you don't realise how old they are. It's the same thing with George North.
Yeah.
He's had 100 caps. He's only five.
I can't get my head around him being like a dad with a beard now.
I know.
George North.
Do you know what? Talk about a player who's turned his career around.
Yeah.
Because I genuinely thought I've gone off topic again now, but you did say.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a player that I thought with concussion as it is, I thought he would just leave that be.
Yeah.
And I still wonder about that sometimes. But the switch to centre.
Yeah.
Totally rejuvenated him.
Yeah. And I really also think you can't underestimate the difference Toby Booth's made in his career as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because he looked miserable playing rugby.
Yeah, he did.
Until Booth took over. And it's the thing that stood out most rather than like results on the pitch. It's like whenever the Ospreys was behind the scenes stuff, all the players look genuinely happy since he's come in.
That's right. And the same with Cuthbert. You look at Cuthbert, talk about a career turnaround.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the Welsh press and fans, they could be septic beyond at the best of times, but I've never seen anyone get it as badly as Cuthbert.
Yeah.
Right. In four, the save since 1987. Nobody has been slagged off like that.
Even Priestland didn't get it as bad as
nowhere near. I'd say Priestland got away with 50% of the grief Cuthbert got.
It's funny though, because like what you're saying about Cuthbert with Priestland, who's probably the natural second choice in that respect, has also had a comeback in the Wayne Pivac era.
He's done
brilliantly.
Yeah.
And those two players have both, as you say, like rejuvenated themselves in a big way, to which point, like, I'm saying Priestland, as of this episode being recorded, his last touch for Wales was knocking over the winning penalty against Australia. How great is that? And Cuthbert has been on brilliant form this year since he's come back in. Who would have seen that coming?
And you know, the older I get, the more I realise you shouldn't write older players off.
Mm.
Right, South Africa are doing it now. You know, they will quite often maybe, I mean, Steyn is probably too far forward, both of them. But Tens in particular, they can play way past 34 now.
Because
you don't need speed.
Yeah, Johnny Sexton. He can basically stand still and just put the ball where he wants.
There is no space in those channels.
No.
You can't go left or right, so it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Whereas if you know, like a mile at the Ospreys.
Yeah.
Barely moves.
Yeah.
But that's it. It's perfect.
You could see Dan Bigger playing for another 6 or 7 years, couldn't you?
He could play till he's 45.
Yeah.
Because he's still fast now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he still can, you know, he's still triple threat as far as I'm concerned.
Mm.
You know, kick, pass, run. He can do all three of those. But like you say, Dan Bigger could play at least another 5 seasons test level. There's no one anywhere near him.
No.
Yeah,
at the moment.
Because he's so driven, but in a way now that I think is like, if he stayed driven in the way he was early in his career, he would have burned himself out. Frankly, he's changed his adapt, and he's clearly like far healthier and more balanced as a human being, but still remains as a rugby player incredibly driven and dedicated. Yeah.
And he's out with Wales.
Yeah, exactly.
That genuinely helps. I always remember Sean Holly telling me that Dan Bigger snuck his head into their coaching room when he was like academy level or younger, and he came in and Sean Holly said, "Oh, so who are you?" Then he said, "I'm going to be your next 10." Straight up,
brilliant.
And he was.
I always remember it being the thing about a young Dan Bigger was he was always described as a very confident young man.
Yes, never shows some confidence. This lad,
confident, yeah.
Yeah.
But you want that, don't you?
Of course you do.
You know, when Dan Bigger retires now, everyone will forget about his chops in.
Right?
And there's a Swansea word for, you know, chops in. But everyone will forget that mouth, same as Johnny Sexton.
Mm.
All of the best. Try and influence the ref.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just do.
Yeah.
You know, it's 10% of the game.
Yeah. Look, we love shithousery on this podcast.
Oh, me too. I tell you, honestly, I love it. If you can get away with it, get away with it. And if it's gouging and Christ, you know, that's...
If it's dangerous, then no.
It's dangerous, no. But, you know, especially in the front row, if you can get away with it, get away with it.
It's that we've discussed it before on one of the videos, but the recent incident with Darcy Swain and Johnny Hill. And Darcy Swain said in his disciplinary, like, I'm really annoyed because he played me. Like, he made me punch him by winding me up all game. And that's a failure on my part because he just psychologically got under me. And it's, you know, it's like a game of chess in that respect.
Mm.
And I love the way he said that. And that's two great second rows. Figuring out how to do each other's jobs is really fascinating, I think.
And they used to do it to Genge.
Yeah.
You know, but Genge now calmed down.
Yeah.
And he's realised, if I can keep a lid on this, I could captain England.
Yeah.
You know, that's the goal.
Remember when a 21-year-old Kyle Sinclair was like seen as this ticking time bomb? He's a completely different player.
Totally. I remember 21-year-old Alan Wynne-Jones, exactly the same.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I remember him tripping a player. I can't even remember what
Dylan Hartley.
Just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And pointless. And you thought, oh my God. And everyone said, he'll never play. Right. Now where is he?
Yeah, I remember that week really well.
He hasn't got the head for Test rugby. Oh, I think he might have.
Yeah, 110 caps later.
I think he probably has.
But the other thing was, that was his last yellow card for Wales until this summer. Until the one where he was offside but didn't make a difference to the play, followed by the one where he didn't touch the ball going out of the ruck.
And imagine that as a second row, where throat grabbing is part of the skill set. So, you know, jumping, tackling, rucking in, what's your throat grab like? You know, is it Etsworth level?
There's a bit in one of these in a mall in this game where one of the French second rows, I think it's Laurent, but it could be any of the French pack, really.
Yeah.
Wins a turnover by punching someone in the throat. Like when the Australian has the ball at the back of a mall and he just punches him in the throat. He kind of fumbles it for a moment. The French second takes it and runs away with it. It's brilliant. I loved
phenomenal.
It.
I love it. Man.
A punch in a windpipe, that'll make you drop anything.
Yeah.
There is one point where there was a particular mall where the commentators, French commentators, by the way, which I always have time for, and they said like, oh, le mall. And I was kind of thinking like, you say mall, I definitely say fight. Like, that's definitely that's a punch fight. Up. Yeah. And like the majority of malls were somewhat, when I say legal, I mean like there was like a 20% legality to it, you know.
Sure.
But then there was that one mall in particular, which, as you say, Paul, it looked like something outside of Wetherspoons in Cardiff.
Yeah, Le Wine Street, not Le Mall. Yeah, but the rucking is the big difference. Mm. I mean, you measure ruck speed now in what's a good ruck speed now? 3 seconds.
Yeah,
just over the average go under that. Yeah,
you look at rucks, then they're about 1.5 seconds because you just couldn't be on the wrong side.
Mm. Well, they're either 1.5 seconds or they're about 12 seconds.
Or they turn into a mall and then back into a ruck and then into a mall. And it's, you don't know what it is.
And then a steady pylon. Yeah,
and it's one of those weird things where you look at that ruck speed. And you almost, and it's this is almost like this conversation of, you know, should we bring back capital punishment and national service? But you almost wonder sometimes if rucking is better than torpedo clean out.
It
can't be because the optics of it are awful.
Yeah.
But you almost think like, you know, just a few studs on the back of the arm is better than being cleaned out by a 20 stone lock. And it's very rare that I look back favourably on that type of rugby. Yeah, it's an unusual situation, really. Because if you look at rucks now, they're like borderline assault every single time. When you've got a second row, you know, and back then, second rows are what, 6'5" and 15 stone, 15'5". You know, you look at boys like Rob Norster and those guys. They are my size, right? If you look if you put me now next to a modern test lock, we do not look the same.
No.
Right. And, you know, getting those collisions, people torpedoing through rucks off their feet, clearly using shoulders, which you didn't see then because nobody would jackal because you just wouldn't be that stupid.
No. It takes a certain level of bravery or stupidity.
But Bezier gets away for jackal in the second half, which is extraordinary. I think it's the only one in the tournament.
I've not seen one yet.
And it's like both these players are kind of like fighting over them and he kind of gets in and rips the ball away. You're like, what's going on?
You're the smallest man on the pitch.
Yeah, I think he's the automatic top jackler in the tournament. It's the French one.
Just did one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But jackling wasn't even a thing then.
No.
I don't really remember jackling as a term until about like even 2000 maybe. Because you just got leveled.
I remember there being in like Rugby World in like 2008-ish when there I was first kind of really paying attention to them explaining what a jackal was. Whereas now it is a given. Now it is just like a part of the terminology.
Yeah.
And it's something we talked about in past episodes that whereas like the attack you can really enjoy from this era, the one thing it doesn't have is you can't really enjoy watching a team defend in the way you can now. Like you can get really invested in watching your team defend and like hold out for a long period.
And the shape of it, because there is no shape.
No.
Yeah. Is there? There's nothing at all.
No. It's kind of improvised. Yeah. I was going to say the only Jacqueline that had back then was Jacqueline Wilson.
Nice, I like that.
So I mentioned the commentators.
Yes.
We have flamboyant French commentary, which I would just welcome at any time, especially on Rugby World Cup highlight reels. I'm pretty sure, though, the first thing they say as the team's running out is Daniel Le Broca Le Croissant. And I feel like I've just imagined that. It's some kind of fever dream.
You should mention that, right? Before they have this... Okay, the recording on YouTube is from ESPN Classic.
Yes.
Which means, one, at halftime, they play the winning try. And they have, like, a couple of the players talking about it, which is ridiculous. But also before, I don't know if either of you watched the two adverts that play between the teams running out.
I certainly did.
I didn't. I wish I had, though.
Oh, man.
Oh.
French advert with just a man shaving. Then his wife is next to him also shaving.
Like teaching him how to shave, I think is what the line of that advert was. Yeah. Very interesting. And the thing is, at first, I thought that she was talking like gibberish. And then I remembered, oh, no, we're watching French television here. So, like,
I can't wait for you to get the World Cup next year.
Yeah, I know. I have a GCSE in French. And yet I struggled through that advert. But then they go to another ESPN advert, yes, of some description.
So, yes. I ran the YouTube auto-translate on this.
Oh, right? I missed a trick.
So basically, it's a trailer for an upcoming show. They're currently showing the 1987 Rugby World Cup semi-final. It's a channel where they primarily, they said like 6 p.m. every day, they show a different classic match. And this is a trailer for tomorrow's, right? It said, this week is very simple via who comes out to talk about them. And then they bring out a guy. And I presume we're supposed to recognize this guy. We don't. Yep. And then he says, bonjour, which is hello. He then begins to talk about the game that he's talking about, the historic game that they're talking about, the teaser. And what he says is, a player comes at the 62nd minute, is responsible for attempting a penalty at 6. Because we have prepared well, we're able to dramatize this kick. It is no longer a banality.
Christ, it sounds like one of my columns. Jesus Christ.
The voiceover then comes back on, right? And their tease for this game is find the sheik, spelt, you know, like the like a sheik.
As in sheik cars or is a sheik perfume.
Like, is that a Manic Street Preachers B-side? Find the sheiks.
Find the sheiks.
Like, sheik is in the, like...
Spell it. That's the easiest way to do it.
S-H-I-C.
K-H.
Yeah, K-H. So, okay. Like, the Arab leader type, whatever. Yeah. So
Not Nile Rodgers.
I'm going to read the full sentence. Find the sheik who leads Syria for Nintendo. Oh my God.
So this sounds like a diplomatic incident waiting to happen. This whole thing.
then the guy comes back on and says, I copied the BBC method because it is arguably the best approach. And then that's the end of the advert.
Okay, so I definitely heard the word aubergine in that ESPN advert somewhere.
Aubergine.
How did that get in there? Because that feels very different to what you just read out to me.
But like, when aubergine. I went back to listen to that sentence, they definitely sound like they say Nintendo.
Oh, I tell you, this is the insight I've joined for.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to give... I thought I was going to come on. You'd be talking about pod systems. Will would be chatting about some new, like, route for scrum halves sweeping in behind.
Not a chance. We're talking about French.
If you want to take about what you said earlier about rugby coverage changing, now is the time.
Oh, guys. Very good.
One other thing I did notice, though, about the, when they show the French team sheet on screen, they have the numbers wrong. So when you look through the forwards, it goes 8-7-5-4-6-3-2-1. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think it's because of the scrum formation that you look at it from the top, you go 1-2-3, and then you see 6-4-5-7-8.
There we go.
From a bird's eye view.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I've had to like spell it out with my fingers there, and sadly the listener doesn't get that experience. It's confusing to explain. It's still a stupid way to write it out on the television screen, don't get me wrong, especially when that's written out vertically. But yes. So the game starts.
The game starts.
Finally. And it's an absolute banger, so we'll get into it. France looked good straight from the off. As soon as, I think it's the first pass you play in the whole game. Like, they make a break and they get sort of 20 metres downfield. And like, oh, wait, they're serious about this.
And, like, the thing Paul was saying about, they recycle the ball really quickly.
They do,
ridiculously quick.
Which is, like, an insane concept for this World Cup. Because we've joked so many times before about every time someone gets tackled, the referee just blows the whistle and goes scrum. Whereas this time, instead, France was so efficient in their support play where they could actually recycle and actually turn it into something decent. And, like, I find that if you can recycle quick ruck ball, even today, it doesn't really matter how good your shape is. You'll still be able to do something with talented players. Even if you don't have a good shape at all, if you've got quick ruck ball and talent, you'll be able to do at least something.
Yeah. Do you know, the one thing I really noticed, that even the role of the scrum half back then was far more important, because a lot of ball just was messy, slow from line out, from everything. And you, if as a scrum half, you spend a lot of your time with your back to people trying to kill you.
Yeah. I really feel
like
them.
Running backs at it.
They're like punching bags at times. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why, of course, I think back then the pass was so important. So, you know, players like Rob Jones for Wales, for instance, back then. You had seconds to get that ball away. Not like now, where you've got ruck trains and you've got time to set your feet and your shoulders. back then you were probably running back and just zipping balls out, and it had to get to the 10. Otherwise, they were over the game. And I think that was really interesting watching, like you say now, about rucks. And in that opening period, the role of the 10, of the 9 then, was not as important as the 10, but it was, I think, more important than it is now, almost.
Yeah.
They used to shield an awful lot of shit.
Yeah, and yeah.
Like, so I've been watching a lot of Georgia from, like, Rugby Up Champions back today.
Yeah.
And you'd be amazed how often their props step in at scrum half and do a perfectly good job.
Really?
Like, that wasn't an option then.
Back
you know,
then,
like,
no. The 9 was a 20-yard pass. It's a 20-yard pass, isn't it, regardless to somebody?
Yeah. Like, and that is constant, you know, every stoppage, as well as trying to run the kind of support lines and so on as well.
Yeah.
As you said, I do think that's a very good point that I hadn't really thought about when watching this back, that, yeah, like, the 9's role is vital.
Yes. Yeah. They and seem to be strong. In the shit all the time.
Yeah.
Nine seem to be in a mess.
Yeah.
It makes Eddie Jones even more relieved Brian Smith wasn't playing.
Otherwise, he'd have been dressed up in blue somewhere trying to get a shot on him. So the next thing that happens in the game, like 2 minutes in, Michael Lynan nails a drop goal from like 40 yards. Yeah. And the thing I love about this is we've talked about how brilliant the game is already, right? And it's great that there's still somebody just playing off pure vibes, because he's got like a pod of forwards outside him off a line out on first phase. And he clearly just ignores whatever they've got pre-called and just go for a drop kick just for banter and absolutely nails it.
It's beautiful. And that I think that shows that how important that game was.
Mm.
You know, first World Cup semi-final. And the other thing to remember, he's kicking a mitre multiplex.
Yes.
Right? Yes. So that's the first ball we ever used as kids. And it was like, it's like kicking a medium-sized mammal, right? It's incredibly heavy.
Wow.
And you can't do much with it. So if you see boys like that kicking, you know, even some of the goal kicking in the second half, really impressive. To kick a mitre multiplex.
Yeah.
And those things need to be added into the equation. Like ball, you know, the ball technology back then is not like it is now. Even more impressive.
I've definitely underestimated that in this podcast.
I tell you, if you can pick one up on eBay, right, a mitre and inflate it to the correct...
Or if really, you can pick one up
it really off. Hurts. It really hurts.
It's like... So Michael Lynan nails a goal from his own half in the second half. Like, spoilers. Yeah. I suppose we'll get onto that because it's amazing.
It's massive.
Or it's later in this half. Sorry, it's later in the first half, isn't it? But enormous kick. But like how, you know how when a game's at altitude, you kind of mentally have like 10 metres onto every kicker's range?
Yes.
Yeah. You think really in this World Cup, we should be kind of reducing 10 metres for the fact like they are kicking an armadillo.
Exactly.
They are hitting a ratosphere somewhere over there.
Yeah. And then, you know, weirdly, somebody tweeted a picture of Paul Thorburn doing his kick in 86 or whatever it was, or 87, I can't remember, against Scotland. And me and my little friend, when we were little, Matthew Bowen, we lived in Gowett and Paul Thorburn. So we used to catch his training balls.
Oh, no way.
So in the Welsh school in Gowett, which was by my friend Matthew Bowen's house. So Matthew, used to get one of his other friends every now and again to come and collect Paul Thorburn's balls.
Oh.
That sounds awful. And that sounds like Jimmy Savile. But it was
the
80s.
You
know, the 80s. It's the 80s.
That's incredible, though.
So we used to catch the balls behind, and we did it the week before he made that kick.
No way!
Yeah, the week I was up there, the week before he did that kick in Scotland. And what was weird back then is the trajectory of the ball was so much lower because it was so much heavier. So if you look at the kicks, the way they clear the post in that match, they're often kind of halfway up the post.
Yeah.
Whereas now you'll see them and they just clear. They clear the top of the post. And they
say, yeah.
10 feet or whatever. Yeah, man, I tell you what, those guys kicking those balls. Oof, different level.
What a great claim to fame.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
That's amazing. So,
if I'm honest, my friend Matthew Bowen's got the claim to fame. I was the clinger on.
You were there. You were there.
Yeah, I was just there hanging
That's
on.
Good enough. That's good enough. Coat. Yeah. We'll get Matthew Bowen on another episode after we've got you on.
Yeah, I don't think we'll get Matthew on. Things haven't quite worked out.
Oh, okay.
My apologies. My swift apologies.
Let's move on.
Okay, cool. So my next favourite thing, right? Australia have the ball just as up the 22 and they send
old Pap Daddy himself, Brett Papworth, yeah. into contact. And Franz make a six-man tackle on him.
Yes! And then what I love is the fact that I think it's Liner gives Pup Daddy the ball, who looks at him, sees the six Frenchmen in front of him, and just goes, "Good luck, son," and passes it to him. And it's the definition of a hospital pass.
Oh, God,
I mean, and he literally gets hospitalized from it.
Yeah.
This is where the term must come from.
Yeah, hospital pass. Do you know that was the other thing? You see a lot of people lying down the floor, on the floor, genuinely on the floor.
Yeah.
They're not waiting for treatment. They're just waiting for it at the world to just end. Isn't it? They are out, which you don't tend to see now.
So, right, here's the thing about that moment with Brett Papworth, because obviously he goes uninjured. Australia do get a penalty and they kick it and they go 6-0 up from Liner. But, right, this is Brett Papworth's last touch of rugby union.
No way!
So he takes that ball into contact, gets absolutely smashed by, I kid you not, six forwards, and immediately signs to play rugby league instead.
I've had enough of that.
God love him.
It's like, you think about it, right?
Less there, I'm
like... Yeah, a two-man tackle, you go like, oh, one low, one high, one left, one right. You've got six-man tackle, you go right, one for each limb and one for each rib.
Yeah, one on the forehead. How would you even split a body into six pieces?
Yeah, exactly.
There are only four limbs.
It's incredible. R.I.P. Brett Papworth's rugby union career after that.
Oh, God.
I do not envy him one bit. And yeah, he goes off and he's replaced by Anthony Herbert. Very sad to see Pap Daddy go.
Yeah, goes to Sydney Roosters, where he spends the rest of his career before retiring age 27.
So he jumped into league.
We went to league. Yeah. So he goes to league after that.
That makes sense.
And then became a commentator of rugby league after that. And commentated for about 20 years. Retired sort of, or kind of disappeared about 5 years ago or something, apparently.
Oh, God bless him. God bless him.
Now that's who you should get on next.
Yes. That's a great shout.
Track down the Pap.
Yeah, and maybe the six French forwards as well.
Get in the six forwards.
Have a good reunion.
Who mangled him?
Yeah. Like what Empire magazine do on like 20th anniversaries of movies, where they get the whole cast back together. We should do this for like the 40th anniversary.
Yeah, I tell you what, there'd be money in that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you.
Right, Brett, you get a slap on each of the six of them.
Exactly. Imagine if you could get people back who were involved in famous rugby fights.
Oh.
And just get the six of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and here's the thing, right? Once you've got Backy's Boaters' number, you've kind of got half your bookings done.
You've
probably got 80%. Yeah. And then maybe Lavanini, get him on for the next 20 years. I mean, he's thrown 90% of the punches I've seen in the last sort of 10 years.
It's a good point because, like, when Gareth Chilcott retired, it's like, well, he's sorted on the after dinner circuit forever.
Yeah,
when Lavanini retires,
oh my God,
if somebody goes into this kind of a business and starts paying people to, you know, recreate old fights, then he's sort of a life.
The Red Card Podcast. Job done. People I punched.
Instant job at Clinton's, the card expert.
Instant job at Clinton's. Yeah,
he's got his whole family inheritance sorted for the next four generations. After that.
Exactly, that's content.
No issue. Yeah, Michael Liner puts in like an incredible like switch kick 50-22, just completely effortlessly,
absolutely
it's
beautiful,
gorgeous.
Yeah,
out of nowhere as well. Like,
and that was my first instinct when I saw it. It's not
because like it's now that thing. Now that that's a law, you just look out for it every single time,
all the time,
and just naturally you think, oh. It's a shame, but
I have never been more wrong than I was on that rule.
Yes, me too.
I've never been more right, weirdly. It's one of the few times I've ever been correct. I remember watching it, you know, in Super Rugby and thinking that will translate perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's made such a difference.
It's great. I've really,
Yeah. It's brilliant, man. Just bringing up the odd wing and it's fantastic.
And we've discussed this a bit, I think, before on the podcast, but one thing I really like is that it's helping it helps the casual fan enjoy kicking a bit more because you have that moment of adrenaline, serotonin when your team hits a 50-22.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's brilliant. That's what they're trying to achieve by kicking it into the corner.
Yeah. It's like the Hail Mary in NFL, isn't it? One in 15 that you go, that's a good... And do you know what? Rugby needs more casual fans than it's got.
Yeah, it does.
That love those big things. It's
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You need more moments to get people off their feet.
Yes, you do. And especially stuff that you can chuck in like 3-minute content.
Yeah.
That aren't big hits because that isn't the, well, that isn't the way the game should be.
Because it can be a game swinger though, can't it? Yeah.
Well, like, and so it's also the same thing we were saying about how you could enjoy defense before, but you didn't necessarily, no, sorry, enjoy attack before, but you didn't necessarily have anything to watch for in defense. Like, the addition of the 50-22 save as well has been really fun.
Yeah.
I love that.
Stuart Hogg's against England and so on.
Yeah,
like,
man.
Fantastic moments.
Totally.
Yeah. And, like, imagine the, like, Matsushima's one from his own goal line.
Yeah, against Ireland. Yeah.
Like, if that was, if that had the added pressure of it being a 50-22 as well, imagine how much more spectacular that moment would have been.
It's that 1.5 seconds you get where the man is racing the ball to the touchline.
Yeah,
and it's just your heart's in your mouth. It's incredible. I love it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, into my
veins. Why I'm all for bringing the crowd in tight to the touchline. Remember when Shaquille O'Neal used to do the same thing in the NBA and then jump into the crowd and just wipe out like 6 pence? That's another level, isn't it? You know, if you've got a second row doing that, you know,
that's who
we're telling. No telling who he'll knock out.
We should have sent those 6 French forwards onto Shaquille O'Neal.
There we go. Do you know what? He'd just flick them away like flies.
Close to an even fight, but suddenly. God.
I've never seen anything like that man in my life. What an athlete.
I was going to say, speaking of like insane kicking, there was a point where, so Didier Cambarero gets the ball, gathers it in his own 22 and thinks, right, let's absolutely thump this downfield. And he does, and the camera swings over and you see the ball bouncing on the touchline, like in the opposition 22. And you think, my God, what a kick. And then the camera swings back and the touch judge stood right next to where he kicked it, just holding his flag up like, no, this is where it went out. And you think, you couldn't be bothered to run 50 meters, could you?
Too tired.
Yeah, you just go, no, ball went out here, mate. I don't know what you're on about. It's like, no, you were on the piss last night and you know it.
And that could be true. You know, if you think of Serge Blanco, so at the time it was reported that he smoked 60 fags a day, right?
Wow.
Every day. Even if that's a lie and you halve it, that's still 30.
It's insane.
Right? That's a lot of fags. And in France, there have probably been gitanes, which are filterless. And he's a, you know, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Insane. And the thing is, like,
so if you were a linesman, I think he's probably smoking bongs.
Yeah. Probably had a cigar before kickoff.
Cigar, couple of bongs, and then, you know, half an E, and on he goes.
Yeah. A quick few sherries before kickoff, and you're fine.
So the referee, right, is listed in all the programs as being Brian Anderson of Scotland, right? But he's wearing a WRU jumper.
Yeah, I was starting to say.
This is the only bit that I managed to research, and I was hoping you two had missed it, and you have.
Okay.
And it's my only moment because you'll outshine me all pod.
I don't think that's true.
I'm going to mute myself so you have your moment here.
But do you know the reason was because the blue shirt would have been a colour clash.
Oh.
Right? Because I thought that it was Derek Bevan.
Yeah.
My picture was so pixelated. And then I looked it all up, and then it was one article. And it said, just before the game, I was told by TV, you can't wear blue. So you'll have to go on in whatever we've got. And he went on in that.
Wow.
And that's why,
This is, it's the original Grannygate scandal.
Exactly. Yeah. And he was told, when you want to run around so people don't think that you're Welsh or played for Wales, to cover the badge. But of course, you can't cover a badge.
For all 80 minutes.
And following some of the fastest wings of all time.
Just,
you know, just run with one hand. And you've got a whistle.
Looks like,
like
his boob hurts. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So that was why. Colour clash.
That's very good. Thank you. That's,
excellent insight there, Paul.
Tell you
what.
Yeah. I feel quite proud now.
Yeah, so you should. One thing I think was quite interesting, I don't know if we picked up on this before, but Pierre Bebezio is throwing into lineouts.
French nines used to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this like a common thing of like...
Yeah, so this is pre my rugby awakening.
Mm-hmm.
But scrum halves used to throw in and then loop around and take the ball.
Right, seven style.
Yeah, so in, loop and around.
Right, okay.
Which still makes sense, really, because they're one of the best ball handlers on the field.
Yeah.
And if you... Weirdly, it's one of the notes that I'd made. If you look at the hookers throwing in then, I would describe the ball flight as hopeful.
Yes.
Right? So it isn't like a direct spiral. I'm hitting this, it's like a little, whoa. So like, where's that going to go? And that's probably why.
Australia's Tom Lawton is quite rare in the fact that, like, as a hooker in this tournament, he spins the ball when he throws it in.
There we go.
He's like, technically, most of them just kind of lob it.
Yeah.
And they throw it without spin. It's like a flat sort of, almost like a poor shot put.
Yeah. Where's Shauna Brown when you need her? Teach to what the day.
Indeed.
Get the ball in.
Yeah. So, I mean, France have a couple of attacks around this time that are very, I mean, Philippe Seller's ability to throw a dummy is a beautiful thing that I could watch all day.
It's ridiculous.
So nice. Yeah. Like, he convinces you as a viewer that he's going to pass the ball, like, most times. And it's just one of those lovely things. Like, he sells it with his eyes and his head and everything. Like, it's all so crafted and considered. And it's just, you could watch it all day.
Yeah. It's a full body dummy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the everything's going.
Yeah.
James Hook used to have that.
He did. Yeah.
Like a proper full body, you know.
Yeah.
I am doing this. No, so, I'm not.
I've been told by a lot of teammates that my one trick is the show and go. And James Hook was actually the player I learned that from.
There we go. Beautiful.
Was, you know, the way that he used his full head. And, like, say what you want about James Hook. Throughout his whole career, he always had a good dummy on him.
Always.
Yeah, and it's the way he sells it with his hips and everything. And I can't quite describe how it... But every time I throw a dummy, I think I'm trying to copy James Hook here.
Yeah. And it's the same with Phil Bennett. It's all the hips go first.
Yeah.
Then the head, and then it's you don't see it too much now, I suppose, because that space doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
But it's like a credible threat, is it? If you've dummy, you're just going to get smashed.
And there's a lot of people think, like, a dummy is, you know, you're just kind of hitting and hoping that they fall for it. But it's a whole process of trying to convince the opposite player that you're actually going to pass the ball. Totally. You almost have to be considering, like, you want to be genuinely thinking, I'm going to pass this ball, and then deciding at the last second, like, no, I'm not.
And then you
had that with Seller. He was always looking to actually release the outside man. And because his passing ability was so genuinely great, just defenders would just slack and hold off him all the time.
Excuse Andrew the pun about slack.
Yes.
He was always a credible threat, wasn't he?
That's it. Yeah.
I suppose that's, I always think of that. I remember Ben Kay using that word about two, and I've nicked it. Are you a credible threat? And I think that's what we saw on the weekend with Argentina. That, you know, the Kiwi backline now, and I am a Kiwi sycophant, right? And I won't apologise.
Right? Please,
I love the All Blacks, right?
Yeah.
Always have done. And I hate watching them play like they are now. But their backline no longer represent a credible threat, do they?
No.
Right? So you've got, you know, Havili and Iwane. They aren't credible threats at 12 and 13. So it's pointless throwing dummies there. No one's buying it.
Yeah. I don't rate David Avili as a 12 at all.
I don't think anyone does.
No, except
that's awful because he's such a good player.
And it's such a waste.
So my theory is, rather than positionally, I think they're using him wrong. You know, they're just trying to use him as kind of a crash ball merchant kind of thing. But actually, he's got great hands. He's got a really good boot on him.
Yeah, like, he kicks.
Yeah, he could be a really good 12. He could be an even better fullback, don't get me wrong. But,
But the...
I don't know why. I still don't know why they let Lamarpe leave.
Yeah. Hell of a player.
That was ridiculous, right? You know, picking Sonny Bill Williams in that squad over Lamarpe, I think that's short-sighted.
He's a brilliant player,
And then, Lamarpe. You know, you've got Jordy Barrett, who to me looks like a 12 all day long.
Yeah, he's been playing in the 20s there a lot.
Yeah, he came through as a 12, didn't he?
Yeah.
If Jordy Barrett, even if he gets everything wrong in midfield, it'll take two of you to drop him.
He's massive, Jordy Barrett, like, when you look at him.
Like, he's proper 6'5".
Yeah.
And properly 16 and a half, 17 stone.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what they're missing. And I know what you're saying about Havili. But you need a credible threat, don't you?
Yeah.
And, you know, they haven't had that since Nonu, really.
No. And,
no one does.
Nonu is, like, maybe the best 12 I've ever been.
He's the best 12 I've ever seen.
So, it's obviously difficult to compare anyone to Nonu, isn't it? It's literally the biggest boots to fill.
Look, the San Diego Legion are going to struggle to replace him as well.
They certainly are. I mean, look, leave us alone. We've got Tian Lutz, all right?
And do you know what's lovely about watching? I'm doing I'm on tangent then.
Please
do.
But that's what's lovely to watch Karevi now, because he's exactly what Nonno did.
The transformation of Simon Karevi is doing things to me.
He was initially all crash ball, ass and legs and a front.
We've had so many, all of a sudden, he's
dribbling balls through in the channel.
It's ridiculous.
He's zipping like mysteries out.
Yeah. We've had so many conversations, me and Robbie have, about Simon Karevi being like really overrated, like several years ago.
Whereas now, having a conversation with an Australian fan about how, if offered both players, I would have taken at the time Owen Watkin over Simon Karevi. And
now that sounds daft.
I do not feel that way now.
No, Simon Karevi is one of the best centers on the planet, like easily.
Yeah, if not the best 12.
Yeah.
And how old is he? He's still got a long way to go.
27, 28, I think.
So he'll go till 32, 33, because he's not a player based on pace.
Yeah.
No. You know, so yeah, brilliant.
And he's already in Japan. Like, you know, he's not going to disappear off of it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and I tell you what, if you're looking to, you know, kick your career on, that Japanese chunk, that's the key to longevity.
Yeah.
You know, you do, you know, I'm not denigrating that league, but the contacts are less.
Yeah.
You know, when the impacts are less, and it's a good, I saw a picture of my dearly departed Hadley Parks today.
Oh.
And the difference in size now compared to what he was when he was playing over here, he doesn't need to be that weight.
Interesting.
To me, he looks like he's lost. This is anecdotal and based on me being a dick, but it looks like he's lost a stone and a half.
Yeah, that's mad.
Like maybe two stone.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need that weight over there.
I decided, by the way, that the Wild Knights are my team in the top league because of Hadley Parks.
There we go.
I love that man as well as you do. Team. Yeah.
I love him.
No, he's still there.
I'm sure he signed for someone else last
week. No, he switched this week.
Yeah.
Has he? Oh, what?
Yeah. He switched he's gone to the Black Rams.
Oh, I'm a diehard fan of them anyway. I always have.
He switched with Goodhue.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
No, it was Josh Goodhue, wasn't it?
Oh, Josh Goodhue, sorry. Goodhue. Yeah, his brother's gone.
Yeah. Jack Goodhue was born on the exact same day as me. Speaking of another birthday facts, you're born on the same day, which means I can always measure myself against him. And you know what? I'm doing all right, but I
doing well.
Have far fewer All Black caps than him.
So far.
And there's someone else moved over as well. The three of them signed this week, and I can't remember who it is.
Right.
Now. But three, you know, big signings.
Yeah,
but that's
the
key to progression of career. I tell you what.
Yeah.
Like, it's a shame that more players aren't doing sabbaticals. Like, work so well for McCaw and
Carter
and Hooper as well. Like, good on him doing what he's done now. And when Sam Warburton did it, you felt, oh, this is a really good move that will prolong his career. And obviously, it led to, you know, in retiring without coming back from it. But I'm amazed more players of that level of profile who've been playing as long as that
don't go,
I'm going to take a year out, you know?
It's a really good point.
Totally. And especially in Japan, because you've earned really good money.
Yeah.
You're still playing high profile rugby.
Yeah.
And the season's half as long.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, so this morning I was watching some of these clips for Sam Warburton was doing for a rugby equipment brand, right? Which I won't mention, or maybe it will, and then you can give him a little tinkle.
Yeah.
So it's Rhino.
Other brands are available.
Other brands are available, unless Rhino want to call in and chuck in a couple of quid.
Yeah, in which case they're not.
But exactly. And
look, there's only one website builder, as far as I'm concerned.
That's true.
When you watch Sam Warburton talking about the breakdown, The level of detail is ridiculous. So this little video he released this morning.
Oh, I know the one you mean.
You've probably seen it, right?
Yes, so they, crack on.
This manufacturer has released almost like a circular donut with a hole in the middle,
okay,
tackle bag. With the idea being that you can hit it and then tackle or jackal through the hole in the middle of the donut.
Okay.
And he was just showing that just the level of, if they roll that donut from the right to the left, i.e. a ball carrier running to that direction, if you hit with the wrong shoulder, i.e. Corabetti, not on the touchline, not only are you putting yourself in danger, but the momentum swing of your body to jackal is being eaten up by the momentum of the player, and right, you swing to a standstill, so you can't get back to make the jackal. Whereas he's saying if you use the correct shoulder, the momentum will swing you around the back and you can use it to lift back up on your feet.
Right, yeah. Which is automatically in the gate, aren't you? And you can just spring straight back up.
And you use that swing, almost like if you're going around a swing ball, if you imagine you being the ball, you use that moment to get back to your feet. And if you think that is what you see the best, they've always done that, right? Pocock, him, Hooper. They use that leverage to go round the tackler to get back to their feet.
It was the thing back before they changed back when the tackler didn't have to release, before they changed that about 5 years ago. Justin Tipperick used to do constantly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where he'd swing around, always kind of, be offside. Take people out of the way, then get in an offside position and just
and then get in.
Yeah.
But, you know, just that level of detail, you know, and I think it makes you appreciate, A, what those players analyse when they're making tackles, and more importantly, what they're missing by not being part of coaching.
Yeah, you think of some of the best flankers in the world, whether that is like a Michael Hooper or a Peter Steph Tatoy or whatever, it's easy to look at them and think like, oh, they're just a big lad, obviously they're going to be dominant. But actually, they'll be thinking that going to every single tackle.
Yeah.
And that's what makes, and again, like, I don't know, like the Anthony Jolanches of the world so incredibly good, is that they know exactly what choice of tackle to make to the smallest degree of where they put their arms, where they put their legs, where they put their head, the lot of it. So it's insane.
There's a lot of big lads out there, and like not all of them are world-class rugby players. You know, like it's, you need that level of dedication and focus to go with it, an understanding inherently of your role, at least, if not the entire game.
Yeah,
totally. And I think when you watch the NFL, people appreciate that level of specialization. But so they'll be, you know, I don't watch it much NFL, but I'm aware of the specialization in each position. They're like,
of course.
And that exists in rugby if you want to watch it.
Yes,
And listen to it, and if you want to see it, and I love it. Yeah, I could listen to Sam Waltman talk.
It's fascinating talking about the breakdown and stuff. Yeah, he's brilliant, Sam Warburton. I love him.
All day.
So, should we go back to the game?
Sorry.
No.
Very welcome.
We all enjoyed that tangent equally.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry.
There's a little like run of Michael Liner being charged down over and over.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why he changed his short, I think. I think he shit himself.
And hey, who wouldn't after seeing what happened to Hatworth?
I'm a big fan of Michael Liner. I think, he changed his shorts. I just thought, right, this could leak through. Let's get him off.
It's interesting because his shorts split at the side. Like they split at the hip rather than at the bottom of something. So he takes his shorts off like horizontally, which I find quite interesting. Yeah. And then just hands them to the guy next to him. Like, and then the crowd realises. Yeah, exactly. And then he gets a new pair of shorts and cracks on. And I'll be honest with you, with some of like the really fun amateur shit that was going on in this World Cup, I'm surprised they just had another pair of shorts lined up for him to play in.
Me too. In the right size.
Yeah. They definitely nicked it for someone on the bench, like. Still. They were Brian Smiths and Eddie Jones nabbed them off him and said, give them to Liner.
Give them to Liner. Oh, very good.
I'll tell you what, considering what happens in the next game, I'm glad that the splitting that happens around the short area is just the shorts this time.
Oh,
yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Considering how close we now are to having to talk about that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, okay. Whew. For anyone that doesn't know at home. Whew.
Yes, content warning for the next episode.
Yeah, tune in.
But yes, so as you say, there was just a constant spree of charge downs, mainly on Michael Leiner. Like, there's a drop goal he does that gets charged down. There's a 22 dropout he does that gets charged down. And
him and David Campese recover from beautifully.
Oh, my God. David Campese. It's the fact that people always, you know, there's a cliche about certain rugby players, if he always beats the first defender, right? David Campese literally always beats the first defender. Yes. And then even in situations like that where he's on his own try line, he gets away from a man really casually, then just really comfortably gets like a 40-meter spiral punt away. And it's just like, that's so valuable for a fullback.
Yeah. He's got a good kick.
People
don't remember that.
Yeah.
You always just remember him glancing in and out and, you know, scoring weird tries on the wing in the 5-meter channel. He's got a massive boot.
Yeah. I'm guilty of underestimating that myself.
Massive boot.
Yeah. And he does put in some really good kicks. As you say, like when the ball's fumbled by one of the backs, or as you say, line is charged down, there's, I think, two occasions where he just steps out of trouble and just really easily, comfortably, casually boots it downfield.
And yet again, with a Mike the Multiplex.
Yes, indeed.
So you can add 15 metres onto that.
Yeah. There's one point where Serge Blanco makes, like, a break and gets France sort of 30 metres upfield. They start spreading it wide. And then eventually they just go, can we just give it to Blanco again? Yeah. Is he back on his feet? And so they do. And he goes full, fuck it, I'll do it myself. And almost goes the whole way. It's so enjoyable watching. And Maynell makes a little break midway through as well.
Yeah.
And it's just a joy. And who cares if he smokes 60 fags a day? You can almost tell looking at him. And it doesn't make him a worse player.
No, it doesn't. There is a point very early on in the game where he's underneath the post and he looks like he's going to spin.
Yeah.
And he hasn't had to do an awful lot. I remember I was watching it back and I was thinking, that's when you can see he's smoking.
Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you, Paul, that's happened in every France game so far this tournament.
Oh, right. There we go. there we go. But I think the other thing, God, I'm trying to talk technically now because I'm on with you boys. But you realise how much more space there is in the 13 channel back then.
Yes.
Because you don't see the 13 diving out and blocking that gap. The 15 and, you know, Legisque and those guys, they can do what they like.
Once you're
on the edge, you're almost free.
We've talked about this. Like, there are two things that are basically unstoppable in this World Cup, right? One is the fullback entering the line at pace. Yeah. And the other is John Kerwin.
Between
the two of them, you know, like, you kind of can't stop either of them.
No.
And as I said, there's a few times where you've got two of the all-time greats. Like, you've literally got two people who break try-scoring records in this game. Like, Campese will get on to, but, like, Serge Blanco here becomes France's all-time top try-scorer, equaling the record that Philippe Seller breaks earlier in the game. So you've got, you know, like, two of the all-time greats here coming in and hitting, as you say, that channel where the 13 is not really pushing out. The 13 is watching the fan. And there was far more kind of like almost football-style man-marking going on.
Yes, well, it was one-on-one.
Yeah.
It was literally, where's, you know, man-on-man.
It's kind of evolved. Like, most defenders nowadays mark the space rather than marking the player. And there are odd exceptions, but, like, generally that's kind of the rule.
Yes.
And that wasn't really happening here. So if you brought the fullback into the line late enough, they were breaking through an awful lot of the time.
And it was the glory day of wings. You know, I remember we used to watch just every weekend watching, you know, Welsh rugby back then. It wasn't called Scrum 5, it was called Rugby Tonight, I think. But all of the tries are scored by wings. You know, there were
Paul McCartney need a lot of them.
Very good. Yeah, but it was all, you know, they were all wing tries and the odd 10, you know, there were no hookers scoring. Right, you know, that was, you know, and no 12s really. It was all to the 13, 14, 15. So I suppose that space, of course, because they were drifting, it just gets, you know, it's weaker and weaker and weaker as the further wide you go, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, and speaking of wings, right, Didier Camembert-Berro, the French winger, is a remarkable player who, I mean, he seems to be so involved for a winger as well. To say, like,
he does.
A lot of the time, as you're talking about in this era, a
lot of touches.
The wing is scoring a lot of tries, but that's kind of most of their touches.
Yeah.
And most of their touches are either running into touch or scoring.
Yes.
But Camembert-Berro is remarkable in the fact that he seems to be involved constantly. And also, like, he seems to, every time he gets the ball, he seems to be under immense pressure. He will somehow jink out of literally anything, then kick it out on the full or just run into touch.
Like, he will pull like a complete miracle and do something stupid.
Yeah, that's
really the most French player I've ever seen.
There's one I love where he gets the ball from Blanco and it's like, oh, he's about to score here, Cambrero, and he gets up to the 5 meter line and does a forward pop. I think goes into touch. And it's just that, it's just like, oh, well, that was brilliant until the last bit.
Yeah, it's almost like dummy sidestep on the full. It's like a little three-set move.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's one point I've written in my notes that Australia run a play called Throw Everybody a Hospital Pass. Where everyone's just like, not me, not after what happened to Pap Daddy. Your turn now.
It's so funny you should mention that, because I noticed the offload height back then tended to be way overhead. There were no offloads at like chest height or you could get your arms in and get safe.
Protect your ribs,
yeah.
At one point later on, they send Campese into like clearly they intend to run the fullback into line move that no one's watching for, but happened to be Philippe Salah was stood right there. He hits him like straight on. It looks like nowadays when you think of like a centre taking the ball into contact, but instantly he's just kind of smashing into Salah, and he just like instantly throws the ball backwards over his head. No idea if anyone's there. And like the thing we talked about rucks, you do not want to be at the bottom of that if you're, you know, if you're David Campese, if you're any of the bags really.
Well, anyone really. Yeah, it was grim. I'll always remember back then, even playing rugby as a kid and used to bath in Dettol. I don't even know if Dettol even exists anymore. I don't know whether they put kids in disinfectant, but I'd come back from rugby and my mother say, oh, I've got a cap of Dettol in there. And then it's like being waterboarded. For about 10 minutes. Oh, thanks, Mum. Yeah, just cry in now. Thanks for that. Yeah, cheers. In all my womb. You've just striped up. But you didn't lie on the wrong side.
Hey, you had to learn your lesson.
You had to. Yeah, you had to
learn it from Eric Champ.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just didn't lie on the wrong
side. When you made your allusion to bring back rucking, that's just because you've retired now.
I never really played.
No,
it
fair
was,
enough.
You know, social rugby to the point where they moved me from second row as far away from contact as they could until I was 24, and then I gave up.
Fair enough.
I think that's a good career.
We took the ball around a car park once. You know, that counts. That's play.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. It's a nice thing.
I think that's why I'm so obsessed with rugby, though.
Mm.
Because I was, you know, not timid, but you need to have an edge to play
at
a certain level.
Yeah.
And I never had that. I think that's where the obsession comes from. And I think that's where the obsession comes from with a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in total...
We're both the same.
Right, total admiration. And it's why I tend never to be negative about rugby or the players themselves, because I'm in total awe of all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you've played once for Cardiff or 50 times for Bargoed, you're better than me.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm always very deferential to anyone who's played at a level as you would be, you know. It's I think that's where it stems from.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm reasonably good at tennis, but far more cruel to tennis players.
it's what happens. Cynicism creeps in at a certain point.
If the better you were, you're the crueler you are, I think. Yeah. The shitter you were, the more open you are.
I'm so cruel to just every professional Tetris player because it's maybe the only thing I'm good at.
Hey, I tell you what, that's not true at all.
I don't know. It's a very short list regardless. I've just managed to monetize one of them.
So far.
Remembering who played in the center for Georgia in an old game.
And look, let me tell you, right? I'm sure your Tetris achievements are better than Jack Goodhue's. So.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Right? What's he ever done?
Jack Goodhue can't do a T-spin. Come on.
No, exactly. Yeah. Who cares about his 30 caps for the All Blacks?
Yeah. And he can spin out of contact, but can he, you know, drop a little
Very good, Paul. Very, very good. I think we're nearly done with the first half, like an hour and a half into this podcast, but there's one point I really enjoy where Michael Leiner misses a penalty and France put it down for the 22, and Pierre Bebezier takes one of the smartest quick 22s I've ever seen, where he like feigns to take it himself really quickly. Then he turns around to Manel, who stood in midfield, and goes, no, I won't do it, you know, and gestures like with his hands like, no, it's not on. And then as soon as the opposition player just in front of him falls asleep for half a second, he just taps it to himself, and it's beautiful. I love it.
It's gorgeous.
France go like nearly the whole way off the back of it as well. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't mentioned the try from the first half.
Oh, yes. Because this is when it gets interesting, because Australia are 9-0 up at this point.
Yeah, and they're thinking, like, very good for it. Like, they are
very,
kicking.
Very deservingly, like, so. Yeah.
As we talked about in their quarterfinal, Australia probably have the strongest kicking game in the tournament.
Yes.
They have the most controlled. Liner is excellent. As you said, Gapese, massively underrated as a kicker.
Yeah.
And Nick Farr-Jones is so good at managing things when the others are spotting stuff.
Definitely. Yeah.
He does a really good job of just, like, keeping everything under control. And yeah. I think, as I said, me and Eddie Jones were very glad he was fit for this, as was all of Australia. So, yeah. So, and it kind of, yeah, comes from a moment of that not quite clicking in the same way of France getting on top in the kicking game temporarily.
Yeah.
When it's generally been Australia on top.
It's interesting because there's a certain category of try in this World Cup where the backline does something amazing and you think, oh, this is going to be one of the tries of the tournament. Then they're put into touch and then the second row scores off of the line out immediately. Yeah. And you go, oh, that was underwhelming. You know, they've got the same amount of points, but it's so much less aesthetically pleasing. And it's exactly what happens because it's from said forward pop that happens that goes into touch from Cambarambaro. And yet Laurier steals the ball from the line out and kind of peels away from it and dives in the corner himself to get France back in the game.
Yeah.
It's a good finish, though. Yeah, like a one-arm sort of winged.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
good. You
yeah.
don't see many players plant the ball down like that anymore.
No.
They're clamped in between the forearm and bicep.
Yeah.
But
it's
when
a risky
you do,
sort of 80s finish.
Yeah. When you do one of those, it's definitely turning up on highlights reels.
Oh,
because it's so, like, from behind the goal line, so aesthetically pleasing to see it slammed down properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, lovely.
As someone that edits rugby videos together, I am using that clip. If you slam the ball down properly, it looks great. It looks great.
Yeah,
yeah. I want more of those.
I tell you what, Shane Williams did a few of those.
Yeah.
The old little arm pinch.
Yeah. He loved one of them. The thing that I always find when in the studio or editing, I always find the back angles of goal kicking, I absolutely love.
Mm.
I always put that in there and sometimes slow it down. Oh,
yeah. Proper wider shot really means you post on the kicker.
Here's
a question for you. So have you noticed, when because you guys obviously analyse an awful lot of videos, but in the 80s, was the kicking arc more from left to right than the modern day, whereas it can be more of a fade, can't it?
Yeah.
It's almost like straight to fade. If you look at modern kickers,
I think
they kick right to left on contact on the ball, and it straightens and goes the other way.
Mm,
whereas back then, they used to worry a lot more about which side of the field you're on.
That is a really interesting point, actually. I think it is still, to an extent, the case, because the majority of 10s will be right-footed. And I think that is probably a big part of it. But I think you are correct, though, still, that back at this point, that probably was already something that was considered. Yeah.
Because they used to arc the ball a lot.
Mm. Yeah. There's far more emphasis now on, like, the planting the foot before you kick.
Yes.
Whereas I think then it was more about, like, the kick itself was the main thing.
Yeah.
Whereas you see a lot more, especially when you watch, like, goal kicking advice and so on, which I, you know, admittedly, I haven't watched that much since I was 16. But whenever you hear it and you know, those kind of stories, there's a lot more is on that planting the foot, on being in position over the ball, head down, all of this.
Yeah.
Like, it's far more technical, the small bits, I think.
Yeah, and they tend to strike the other way now, don't they? So they tend to almost slice the ball against the grain, whereas back then they used to arc around it.
I've just realised your question was about goal kicking, and I just answered it about up and unders instead. So I have no idea about.
No.
I know nothing about goal kicking. My bad.
No, it's that arc because they almost used to run. They used to take three steps back and then two to the left. So you sort of came around it like a circle.
Yeah.
And then the bad miss back then was a drag, which you'll notice a few of them dragged it by a long way. Whereas now the bad miss is a slice.
Yeah.
Like the Sexton, you know when Sexton does his awful miss? It's always a slice, isn't it?
So it's always something to look forward to, that. You know, because you know it's coming up every Six Nations.
Yeah.
He will miss at least one kick, probably two in a row, he often does, horribly.
Isn't it weird? Because he's such a good goal kicker ordinarily. Yeah. And then just now and again.
It goes.
Snap under the right.
The classic getting the yips thing. Like Andre Pollard the other week. Like when he just went from under him. He just suddenly couldn't. And like
do you guys think of Pollard?
I really rate him. And I think
I think he's a really, really good fly half. But I think you would never show a kid like this is how you play fly half. considering it, like he's very good specifically to the Springboks, kind of what they want in a 10, like the identity that they want.
I think he's exactly the 10 Razzie Erasmus wanted. And I thought, I think Jacques Nienaber wants something slightly different. And I think there is actually like growth in his game in the last 2 years. Like, and I think watching him in this Rugby Championship, the two games against the All Blacks, like I, and the games against Wales as well, that second or third test, I think we were seeing more of him managing play, which isn't something he traditionally did. Like, he used to be far more like phase by phase rather than like a George Ford or Paolo Garbisi, if I come into mind, like Dan, you know, a
lot
of like
extremely scripted,
tend to kind of think like three phases in advance. And they're going like, I know what I want here. And I'm just going to drop a pass as I don't want to be involved myself. Where, and I think Paul is starting to develop that a bit. And I wonder if going to Leicester, where they used to, George Ford will help with that.
There is also the factor of like, he always kind of left that to Willy Larue. Whereas now he's kind of had to do a bit more of himself because Villarreal's been used as a finisher, as it were, rather than being on for the full 80 minutes. So
what do you
I don't know if that's a part of it. Yeah.
I think he's perfect for the box.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I ask, because of the, you know, the fallout from the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I watch more South African rugby now than pretty much anything.
Since
the URC, because I, you know, I write a lot
more
of
than your mum does.
Yeah. And my mother is all over, you know, the Bulls. Sort of
we're
going
to have to change your name to Paul Willemser, like, so you can be the second Paul Willemser and go like eight up the pecking order.
That would drop me down to 10th then in that list of Paul Williamses. But yeah, it's difficult because they are the ones who don't seem to that's the one position they haven't got much behind.
Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it?
So they don't really have an option, do they, to switch it?
Yeah. And like, I rate Elton Yankees higher than most people.
I do too.
But
he's not their 10, is he?
He's not.
He's not what they're looking for. And that's that.
Yeah. It's interesting, developing a theory here. Would Elton Yankees be viewed as a better player if he was Japanese? As a question for
you. Yes, he would.
Well, he would be, yeah, because he would. That's exactly the way they play.
Yeah, extremely like attacking-minded, even when it's not going his way. I've never thought that before now. It's completely organic.
I think
it's really good. That's bang on.
Like, he plays in a team in the Japanese league coached by Ruan Ackerman. Like, that is the perfect fit for him as a player.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's you should maybe think about requalifying. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, but I think the difficult thing with that South African 10 position, there's nobody really much underneath.
No.
And I mean back, you know, almost three or four positions.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, the depth like, really isn't there, really. It's not like they're dripping with 10s anyway.
They called it Mornay Steyn, aged like 67 last year.
Yeah.
I suppose you're 66 at the time. But
I know. And it's the only position they're not deep in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you know.
So like... Willems playing this. We should probably talk about the game, shouldn't we? I realize we're almost going for 2 hours.
Sorry.
I don't want to keep
it
too long.
I don't know
how much time you've got, Paul. I don't want to be like...
I could literally talk forever about rugby.
Well, in that case, let's do this. First 7 hour episode.
Yeah.
Right, we'll talk until someone dies.
Okay.
It will be one of us. It will be a listener.
Snuff rugby.
Should have named the channel that.
Yeah,
it's really interesting that this is going to be the first episode where the episode itself is longer than the time elapsed between the game finishing and the starting recording.
Yeah, exactly.
We're into the 36th year of recording.
Switching off.
And we're all enjoying it, so it's fine.
I'm so sorry. You'll never have me on again.
No, it's all right.
It's, Paul, I'm enjoying it so much more than when we don't go on tangents. So I encourage more of it. You're not doing enough. All right, Paul.
We'll definitely have you on. We'll just start recording at midday.
Yeah, exactly.
But we finished at the same
time.
We've
been on an hour 50 minutes.
Yeah. We're doing well. And we've got to half time finally.
Right. Skip through.
So.
No. I had one last note on
the try.
Because it is like a beautiful bit of just like he literally reaches in, kind of goes yoink, and then just dives over the line.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I had such images of Adam Beard having that wet dream as a teenager.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very... Or Scott Williams, or James Hook.
That kind of
rip and strip.
Yeah, that's the try from this game that Adam Beard watches back, not one of the other ones that comes up.
I tell you what, there's an improved player.
Oh, mate, yes.
Let me tell you.
I mean, the thing I love about Adam Beard is how no one talks about James Ryan anymore.
At all.
Because when they came for it at the same time, and everyone's attention went to James Ryan instead.
Yeah,
and only one of them is a test lion.
Yes.
Adam Beard I'm not saying he's going to be Alan Wynne-Jones by any stretch, but he's like a 10-year lock.
Yeah. Because you know, he has that one skill where he's the best in the world at it.
Yeah.
And he's being an
fucking
octopus.
Massive.
He is.
As Warren Gatland said, you can't coach someone to be 19 stone.
Well, it's more than that. You can't grow people who've got heads like commercial bins. Right? If you stand next to those lads, right, you can tell the ones who are just born genetically second rows. Because their heads are massive.
And the best thing is, right, he has married a Welsh international netballer who is also almost
genetic,
his height.
Genetic breeding program. I'm all for it.
We have like another generation of world-class second row coming through in 20-odd years' time.
They've got
two kids.
My wife went traveling to New Zealand in 2000. That's the only time I said she could ever cheat on me. Right? If she found a Maori who was 6'4 and could do the 112. And I said, just get pregnant, bring the baby back, and we worry about it later.
Yeah. As long as he's born in Wales.
Then we'll have the next kind of Lomo. Or if he hasn't got the handling, we'll switch him to 8.
Perfect.
And then we'll worry about that later, all right?
Write it in the small print that you can take the credit for it. Perfect.
I know.
I love it.
No one will ask any questions. It'll be fine.
No, it'll be fine. Yeah. Exactly.
Name him Paul Williams as well, so he can drop down the list.
Yeah.
But then I could almost say that Samoan heritage. That's the link. I can say I'm sort of linked to that Paul
That's
Williams.
That's it. If you're if one of your descendants is called Paul Williams and goes further up the list, you stop caring about where you
exactly.
are.
Exactly. And then the lie gets deeper. And then all of a sudden, then I'm on Netflix. Aren't I? The great Paul Williams lie.
Will Smith will play you in a biopic.
Yeah. He fucking lied continually, then went on a podcast for 2 hours and then fessed to everything.
We will keep you on here till you admit to crimes. That's our promise to every guest.
Oh, God.
You won't believe what Blaine Scully owned up to.
There's another good player. He's one of my favourites too, Blaine Scully.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah.
Love him desperately.
He had a touch of the Tommy Bowes.
Very handsome man.
We had him on like maybe 10 episodes into this podcast, and I still think every day about how much I just came across as a fanboy when we had him on.
I know. Do you know what? I don't care if I come across as a fanboy because I am.
I like tried to play it cool for about 10 minutes and then came out like, by the way, Blaine Scully, I love you.
Yeah, it's not worth it. Whenever people say you should act like a journalist, I'm not a journalist. Yeah. I'm a rugby fan with a couple of columns. I love him. Get out of my way.
I think very similarly. In the same way, like, I kind of feel like it's not my place to be meeting players and interviewing them because I kind of I talk about them, you know, like it's a different thing. But like, one of the best moments of my life, genuinely, was Blaine Scully texted me saying Happy New Year. And I felt, what a thing. What a thing. What a lovely man. He didn't do it the next year, like, but I don't care. New Year, for all I know.
I'm sure that you fulfilled your obligation, had a nice year.
I had a lovely year. All thanks to our boy.
Skull Dog.
Skull Daddy.
Josh mentioned this on Blood and Mud because I mentioned to him the kind of off air. But so like if you follow someone and they follow you back and your Twitter account is linked to your Nintendo Switch, it comes up as a suggested like you can add them as a friend.
Yes.
And for a very long time, I was toying with adding Blaine Scully as a friend on Nintendo Switch, sending him a request.
What's your chosen game?
Oh, Mario Kart. Come on.
I
could absolutely take Blaine Scully.
I wouldn't fancy racing an international winger, but yeah, go on.
One day I'm going to take him on a Tetris 99 and then I'll live up to it. And I finally did it. I had someone around, I explained this story to someone else while they were at my flat and they just went and just added him. And he has not responded to the friend request yet, but it's so he hasn't been online in a while. So we'll see. We'll see if me and Blaine Scully can one day play each other. Yeah, at Smash Bros.
Visit each other's Animal Crossing islands. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I think I really enjoyed though, because like I could look through what he played lately, and it was like, oh, he's been playing Mario Party. Cool.
Yeah,
The thought of Blaine Scully playing Mario Party just really fills my heart.
But you know, the amount of players who play Call of Duty.
Yeah. Right. But isn't it great that Blaine Scully's the one who plays Mario Party?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So fitting.
It's really niche.
Yeah. Oh, what a player. What a guy. Love that man. Should we look at the second half?
Yes, please. Okay.
So the very first thing I've written in my notes is Sela, you beauty. Because he scores pretty much as soon as the second half starts, and he cuts it, like, he cuts inside and sidesteps, I think, about 50% of the wallaby population of the earth. It's incredible.
It's lovely.
It's just a beautiful, like, there's a lovely break by France in the lead up and them kind of starting to offload and then recycling the ball. They get it wide. It is like textbook rugby, especially this era, but generally as well.
Yeah.
The way the forwards burst through. Who is it? Rodriguez, I think, makes a big carry. And then from there,
him staying at full pace the whole time he's running, even when he's changed direction, when he's throwing the dummy, he's always at full pace. He doesn't slow down to make the pass or anything. Yeah. And like, that will never change.
Yeah. Each pass is beautifully timed until especially the one that isn't thrown.
Yes.
Like he times his dummy so well. Yeah. And then the step and the glide.
His balance. Oh.
And I've seen this try how many other times in the past, just for kind of like rugby ether seeing stuff.
It is gorgeous, isn't it? It's almost like ripped denim. You know, the way he sort of goes through, it's like, and it's really abrasive. And I think that, you know, what's good about that second half is that the space in those outer channels become even more so.
Yeah,
there are no subs.
And the teams clock onto it, don't they?
Right, and there are. This is how we're going to win. There's no bomb squad coming on.
No.
Right, there's nothing. It's like surfing without a leash. Right, you're on your own in the second half, and if that board goes, then you're dead. Yeah. And that's where that space is, and that's why we see those lovely tries in the second half. That's where the width is, and it's
we've
gorgeous.
Spoken before at points in this World Cup that very occasionally you'll have a player's ego take over them in their head and, you know, do a stupid kick that's not on or something because they just fancy it. There's none of that in this game at all.
At all.
And there's one really good point I noticed where I think it was Sela gave the ball to Lajiske on the wing and points pump it downfield rather than doing it himself. And it's just like, oh, right, he's noticed that he's got like a left-footed kicker outside him who is more qualified to make that kick than him. And it's just like, it's such a high level of rugby IQ to think through that.
Is so far ahead of his time, man.
Yeah,
like, looking amazing.
Imagine him playing now. Imagine him playing with this, like, if you had Fiku inside him with Untermack and Dupont and how well he'd slot into that team and how well he'd fit in.
And he'd be 15 kilograms heavier.
Yeah.
You know, he'd have all the upper body and the fend. Yeah. He had a good fend then.
Yeah. He did.
Imagine how good he could be now. Like, not to take away from how good he was in his day.
That's right.
As good as any rugby player.
But there's so few players in this World Cup where you can say they would translate it without
any real... You can drop them exactly as they are.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you could drop them in, give them like 3 weeks of strength and conditioning training and he'd be ready, you know?
Yeah. I think Michael Leiner's one of those.
Michael Leiner's absolutely one of those.
Excellent.
Michael Leiner's fantastic.
That game, Michael Leiner's playing the same game that Tens are playing now.
Yeah.
Exactly the same game.
Yeah, it makes you realise he's probably, and we'll find this out, I suppose, as we go into more past World Cups, but like he's probably quite a groundbreaking player in that respect because he's the most intelligent kicker, Bob, maybe Grant Fox, in this whole World Cup.
Yeah.
And I say maybe Grant Fox because they're pretty much on a par.
Yeah, I think he's...
Yeah.
I think it's Leiner. I think Leiner's the best kicker.
Yeah. They're both phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, Leiner is... It's all up here. It's all in his brain, you know, the way he thinks about where he's putting the ball. And... Yeah, he always lands it perfectly. And speaking of, right, these sort of plays that you can translate, Campo and Leiner in conjunction together, because as soon as this try goes over for France, Australia hits straight back. And it's the point where I just think, good God, this is an amazing test match.
The lead changes hands 5 times in the second half.
How good is that? And the thing is, right, there was a point where I thought, like, is this a great test match or is it just the first one in this World Cup where we've got a scoreboard? I think it's both.
Do you know, the other thing, though, that also helped was the 4-point try. Right, so you never got to pull ahead.
Yeah, it's true, actually.
Right.
It paid off in this game.
Yeah, so, you know, a try back then was not meaningless, but it was just one more than a penalty.
Yeah.
So, whereas now, of course, you score 3 tries, you clear.
Yeah.
Largely.
That's a really interesting point.
This try, Michael Liner gets the ball, cuts inside, really nice sidestep, makes the break, and then, without really needing to give it any thought, throws this perfect miss one over to Peter Grigg on the right wing. And the thing is, at this point, I thought, like, oh, he's blown it. Because, like, any other 10 in this World Cup has tried that pass, and it's not come off, it's been dropped, or it's been intercepted, or it's gone into touch, or it's missed the man, whatever.
Yeah.
But this time he nails it, and Grigg catches it off his chest and feeds it straight back inside, and you think, like, oh, okay, this could work. And then you see it's David Campese and think, that's an 100% try.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's a brilliant support line by Campese, because he changes where he's coming from so late and so well. Because he's initially trying to get on Liner's shoulder, and then adapts, drops back, drifts in a bit so that he's in the perfect position away from Lagachet in order to take that. And then, you know, angles his thing perfectly to hit the corner.
Yeah.
Finishes it. Four. This is his 25th international try, which breaks Ian Smith's record, which has stood since 1933 of 24 tries.
So that's his 25th international try in that game.
Yeah. This is Campese's
25th
try.
Early in his international career. This is retired for another 10 years after this.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he played in 95.
Yeah.
So this is his 25th try, the one that breaks the record, right?
Good God.
Yeah. He goes on to score lots. Lots is the official number.
I'd say somewhere in the ballpark of 70.
So he scores 64 tries in total for Australia.
Right.
64. This is his 25th try in the record breaker and the 64. Big one.
Wow.
Jesus Christ. That's and incredible. He's already world class at this point.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And yeah, as you say, who else would you want but Liner to pull up that try, you know, and bring up the record? It's incredible. It's a great moment of drama as you see the best player in the world at finishing those opportunities is the man taking that pass. And you think, oh, okay, he's scoring here. And he does. He finished it brilliantly in the corner and brings the score back up to 13-12 at this point. There's not much in it. There's not much in it. Right. And it's Australia going like, no, we need
to... I've got the game running in the background.
Nice. But just as France have established themselves...
So, hold on. No. So, Liner takes the conversion, right? However, there's another thing that happens here, right, in the middle of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michael Liner is lining up this kick goal, right? This conversion. Crucial conversion, which would... Would it put them level or would it put them... No, put them back ahead? Or are they
put them ahead.
Put them ahead.
They go ahead and then this would make it 15-12.
Okay. So, really important kick, right? Michael Liner then notices a ball boy about 12 years old standing there next to him in the way of his run-up. Right? So he looks at the ball boy as if to say, you shouldn't be here. The ball boy doesn't move, but turns to Michael Liner and says, this is a pretty important kick, mate.
Really?
No way.
Liner then says, thanks, I know. This is the semi-final of the World Cup. The ball boy then says, well, you'd better get it, then walks off.
You are fucking kidding.
And that child grew up to be Nick White.
So Michael Liner, this is in his autobiography, he says that he nails it. He then sees running back for the restart. He glances over the sideline and sees that kid standing on the touchline giving him a thumbs up.
Jesus, is that real?
Yeah. That's in Michael Liner's autobiography.
That's ridiculous.
Oh my God.
Better kick this. How old is the kid?
About 12, he says.
Fucking hell. That's so Australian.
And he's already a qualified kicking coach. Incredible.
Yeah, it's only 12. Yeah.
How old was Neil Jenkins at this point?
Yeah. That's incredible. Brilliant. The thing is, because this game wasn't even played in New Zealand, because I thought that would be funny if it was like the opposing fan.
Yeah.
He's doing it to like piss him off.
Kiwi, yeah.
That's one of his own fans.
The other great thing about that kick, right, is it also breaks the Australian point record for Michael Liner. 164 breaking Paul McLean's record.
So how old's Michael Liner in that game then?
I think like 24? He's quite young. It's quite early in his career.
Again, he has a long career after this, doesn't he? So,
10 years after that.
Yeah, 24.
That kid, though.
He's 23. 23, sorry.
We need to track that kid down somehow.
Yes.
Got to.
I mean, he's probably, you know, in his late 40s at this point, but we'll give it a go. See if he remembers that conversation.
That's brilliant research. Fair play.
Yeah, fair play.
That's brilliant, Squidge.
That's made this game even better, because that was the conversion where I thought, like, oh, right, this is a serious test match now.
Yeah.
And as I say, it does help actually having the scoreboard in front of us and realising...
Michael Liner's got... Yeah. Michael Leiner's goal kicking, right, where the only two misses hit the post.
Yes.
When he is phenomenal kicking display by, as you say, like when he's kicking an armadillo, it's very, very impressive.
Incredible.
You know, when he's, yeah.
I love the one where it hits the post and it bounces back into Bebezier's hands. And then he dummies one way, pops it the other one, and doesn't realise David Campese stood in the way, who goes for the little slap-up intercept. And you think, like, oh, he's going to score and seal the game here. And the ball just doesn't quite fall his way and falls on the floor.
Yeah.
The offloads were a lot riskier
back
then. They were proper offloads, weren't they?
Yeah.
10 foot in the air, 15 foot back.
Yeah. This is the most we've seen them actually go to hand, though. I think this game, throughout this World Cup, I mean, there's a few France throw where you think, like, well, this is fucking stupid. And it's like, next thing you know, Blanco's 50 metres downfield. Like,
I think the handling errors are the things that really stand out.
Yes.
Because they look really chaotic, don't they?
Yeah.
Like sloppy and... But then I suppose if you're all doing them, it doesn't really matter.
It's true. Then France don't hang about in hitting back Australia. As I just have written in my notes, Lagisque!
Beautiful.
What a try.
I know.
What a try.
Someone else can call this one.
Well, I have written in my notes, a glorious try, Blanco, you bastard.
I have Blanco, you madman, written down.
It is gorgeous, though.
It really is.
And, you know, to the point that that word, Lagisque, in my memory, isn't even like a rugby player. It almost sounds like a car. So I, do you know, I've heard it so much as a kid.
Mm.
It's almost like someone saying like Jaguar or Ferrari.
Yeah, I mean, he is pretty fast.
Lagisque. Yeah, it's he's not a rugby player, weirdly. He's like a sort of like a beautifully crafted engine. Isn't that? But that is genuinely how I remember him.
Yeah. So to kind of paint the picture of the try,
Michael Leiner gets absolutely smashed.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Bless him. That kid would not have been happy.
No.
That kid's probably lobbing stones at him.
So Leiner gets smashed, the ball gets stripped, and you kind of have a moment of going, oh, it could be on for France here. And like, oh no, it is on for France here.
They're under the balls.
Yeah.
You realise it's on for France when Blanco gets the ball.
Yeah.
And it's the way he weaves inside, then outside, and he transfers the ball into one hand. And you think like, oh, he's just going to go himself. And I think that's deliberate.
Yeah, I do too.
He wants everyone to think that he's going to go himself before he just flicks it onto Lagisque.
I noticed that. That ball in his hand, that's like a tell in poker.
That's like him saying,
I'm doing it, I'm going.
Yeah, this is bait.
But then he doesn't.
Yeah.
I noticed that.
A really glorious thing about Serge Blanco is like there are so many players in this competition, when we watch it back, that have kind of like auras around them that you hear things about, right? And we then watch them back and gone, well, they're okay, you know, but watch them with hindsight, you're kind of like, oh, they're fine. Yeah. And every time Serge Blanco gets the ball, I think I'm about to have that thought. And I never do.
That's it.
He's so inexplicable. He looks like nothing he's ever going to work. He's always going to make the wrong decision. He's always going to, you know, not pass when he should or pass when he shouldn't. Yeah. And every time it comes off,
he has that really cool, casual, lazy thing that he does where he'll just disappear from a game for 5-10 minutes and do nothing, right? And then the next time he gets the ball, as I say, he's either pumped it downfield, he's made a line break, whatever. And like when he sets up that try, he looks like he's going for a walk in the park, but he's just casually snapped two players' ankles.
But the thing, he's got proper gas.
Yeah.
So when when I look back at Blanco, I never really thought of him as being that fast. It was more like a positional fullback, and when he was on the outside, he did the right thing. But he's really quick.
Yeah, and never looks like he's sprinting, which is
ever. No,
so,
you've got
so
that
strange.
Gavin Henson languid.
Yeah.
He's obviously faster than Gavin Henson. But, you know, that kind of, that pace.
Yeah.
And then, speaking of pace, man, Lagache.
What a finish.
But there's clearly a moment where he looks up and thinks about the pass, then goes, actually, no.
Yeah.
And he goes.
He does. He hesitates, then goes, actually, wait, I am fast.
I could do that.
There's that foot race between him and Greg, and then Campo on the angle, and he just burns the lot of them.
Yeah.
Oh, it's into my veins again.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It's just like a beautiful finish.
It's one of those things, the best wingers of the world just know how to do it. That moment where you just become, in a good way, like arrogant about your own pace and think like, no, nobody is stopping me here.
Yeah, but that is their job.
It is, yeah.
You know, we in modern rugby, you get a little bit, oh, can they, you know, it's all about kick defence. And, you know, can they shield the ball and can they run like a shield line? That's not their role.
Yeah.
Their role is to, like, terrify people.
Yeah.
And make you think, I can't cover you inside or out. And those French wings did, didn't they?
Yeah. Fantastic. You know. Fantastic. And, like, yeah, he's outpacing really quick, great players. Yeah.
He's got Campese covering back, man.
Yeah.
Proper so quick boys.
Yeah. And it's great. Again, like, you've got three tries on the bounce, all against the grain. And you just think this test match could go absolutely anywhere at any time. I love it.
This also, of course, is around the moment this is the moment where we have the Bezier turnover. And the best thing about this, right, is not only does he do a jackal, he does a dive pass and a process to get it away.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Which is, that's so 80s.
Yeah.
The best
phenomenal
thing is,
moment.
The turnover he makes, the tackle originally comes from two players who are over 40 metres offside from a kick. And I have no idea how they get away with it. But I'm impressed nonetheless. And it's not cheating if you don't get caught. So,
yeah. But you know, that dive pass that we were talking about earlier, scrum halves back then used to be in a mess all the time.
Yeah.
And that's
where
the scrum pass comes from.
Yeah,
that dive pass is like, I've got nothing else I can do now. I've got to fling this from here to there.
How many dive passes have you ever done, Will?
You know what? Necessary dive passes, maybe one. Yeah. Unnecessary dive passes, 15. However, we're in quadruple figures.
Yeah, totally.
Like, the amount of times I've just kind of shat myself and just flopped to the floor to get the dive pass away, even though it's not really a thing that much these days.
Were they spiral or end on end? Dive passes.
More spiral, I think.
Oh, it's the end on end. You've got to do the dive end on end to go full 70s.
Bring it back.
I'll do that next time I play.
Next week. And I get smashed by a back row forward trying to
do it in touch on Friday.
challenge accepted. Yeah.
Don't do it in contact. God love you.
I say three tries on the bounce. There is a fourth one, but I just have written down, what the fuck is this try? Some kind of mad illegal steal equalises the game.
Yep.
Anyone any ideas?
What the fuck is this try?
That's about right. Kind of sums it up. I have, in all caps, what a bad try.
Yeah.
There we go.
But it's David Cody like for like with the French try in the first half. Yeah, you see. The ball just kind of like, France have a line out. They kind of secure it a bit. They have a ruck there. Ball just spills out. David Cody goes, oh, thanks. And scores on the corner.
I was going to say, I have no idea how he can feasibly be onside there.
No.
I don't care, right? I could not care less because it's just a fun try where he's just completely improvising. I don't think he expects it to be given. And then when it is, it's just like, oh, yeah, well, that's vibes. So,
and it's also now why you have ruck guards.
Yeah.
Mm?
Very true.
Because that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, very true. Very true. So that try happens and it equalises this World Cup dramatic semi-final.
Yeah, Michael Lynon nails the touchline conversion to bring it level.
With a mighty multiplex.
Yeah. And both teams go into full-on drop goal mode and I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing that happens, right, as Cody scores, is Denis Charvet, the French centre, falls with his hands on his face to his knees. Like, he's like, oh, no! Like, full-on, like, woe is me. Hands on his face, falls to his knees, starts shouting and screaming and crying. And it's so French.
Yeah.
Like, everything about this French team is so French, right down to the centre, starts crying and equalising try with 15 minutes to go.
Such a French game, this. It's
gorgeous.
It. Yeah. But yeah, so Maynell attempt to drop goal, bloody good effort.
Yeah.
Like shaves the upright. And
I love the kind of that very bomb nature of
it. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You don't see it coming at all because he's in the corner.
It's that
really difficult position.
Yeah. He just says to Australia, no, you're not equalising against those lads.
Yeah, like, exactly.
We're going ahead again, but just misses. It's a really bloody good attempt with the Mitre, whatever it's called.
Multiplex.
Yeah. I need to remember that. Mitre multiplex.
I'll track one down. I'll send you one.
The mammalian snail.
Horrible thing.
Mammalian snail. That's the one.
Slug.
France carry on just being magic after that and just do some mad shit. Do like one of those moves where it's like there's like four switches in midfield and like seven inside passes and you just think like, well, this had better result in a line break, and it more or less does, and Lajiska nearly scores another one, but I think put into touch by Grigg. somebody covers across really, really well.
That's
amazing.
Campo, right. Rare moment of defending.
There's a point, right, where the referee pauses the game and he calls over Daniel De Bronca and he tells him off and he does like a punching motion. Yes. So I'm not sure if he punched somebody. I look back at the footage and couldn't see anything.
That's probably 1 of 10 punches, though.
Yeah, that's true.
The fact that we have had, in this World Cup, punches to the face that the referee has said, less of that, please, and not penalised.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing.
Yeah. No.
Some of the things you see now, that would be, they'd be like 14-week bans.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, just play on. Don't do it again.
You know, we'll have a word, but we'll be fine. It's, you know, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, one of those players that should be in modern rugby, drop the Constantine brothers from Romania in. And you haven't seen the ball, but they just punch people and they're great.
Well, they do. Both just fast lads who punch people.
Both of Romania's second row are brothers who are enormously tall and just punch people. That's and they are my favourite players from this World Cup.
They're like, I'm expecting them to be in your team of the tournament, Robbie.
Yeah.
All they've done is punch people and score one like worldy try. But other than that, you know, I still expect it.
Well, I tell you, but that, the 4 or 5 years after that, Romania were a reasonable sign. Mm,
Around the peak of Romanian rugby.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, anecdotally, I'd say that's the reason why that added to some of the Welsh players going north.
Mm.
Right? So not just the money on offer, but that big loss that Wales had to Romania.
Yeah,
that tipped.
Yeah,
a couple of decisions makes over, sense. Like yeah. We're off north.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
that tracks.
Oh. That was about 1991, I think.
Blame those Constantines and their punching.
There we go. You can only take so many punches to the throat, and then you're off to witness.
You can't help it. You've got to go and live in Wigan.
Takes us 15 more years.
You might as well stay there.
It takes us 15 more years to discover Yestin Harris. Unbelievable.
Oh man. Don't get me started on that waste of money. Oh, you're still paying that off.
It's coming out your tax.
Jesus.
So Australia go downfield. And it's one of those things which is...
Oh,
go on.
This the slack kick.
Yes.
So there's go a moment on. Slightly earlier, right, where Menzel puts in a brilliant kick. Campese kind of cleans it up, like steps about five people and then allows Herbert to clear. Yep. Brilliant work, right? They get downfield. Australia turn the ball over. And then having been so under pressure on their own line, they get the ball to Andrew Slack, their captain, who puts in a phenomenal kick. Like,
unbelievable.
Splits the backfield, puts them under pressure, right? But like, he doesn't just kick it into the 22. He kicks it into the bloody Hurt Arena. And suddenly, out of nowhere, right, we have like Jacques Nienaber defence takes over.
Yeah.
Like, and from having been no defence whatsoever in this game, really, to suddenly this like incredible rush pressure defence from Australia.
It's one of those unbelievable things. And we spoke earlier about the 50-22 being like a moment in a game. That's not a score, but it gives you that bit of serotonin when your team's just done it. And a big turnover penalty when the game is tight is one of those things, especially in the opposition 22 or their half. And that happens, and that's the first time I've seen that happen in this whole World Cup, right? Is underneath the sticks, Australia get one of those penalties from France holding on in their own 22.
77th minute.
Yeah.
Like, and they charge in a few phases in a row and, like, absolutely smash them, carry them backwards, and then fly in again the next phase.
Yeah, and pressurise the breakdown.
Yeah.
And come up with the penalty, and Liner obviously slots it to make it, 24 all at this point?
No, 24-21.
24-21, yeah. Of course. Yes. Only for David Campese to shoulder somebody off the ball, like immediately off the kickoff. And just like, oh no, 24 all.
Yeah. No card, though.
No card.
No card.
Shoulder straight in the face.
Yeah.
So the fun thing about this as well, that penalty goes over on 80 minutes, but we still had injury time as a law then. So that should have been, I guess, the last kick of the game by modern standards. But because he hadn't been stopping the clock at this point, they instead play on and they go, we've got a few minutes of injury time after this, making it 24-0.
You know, I didn't even notice that. That's brilliant, Squidge. That's detail, that is.
Pap daddy time, you know?
That's brilliant.
Yeah. The overtime of what happens when you've got somebody running into six French forwards. Into borrowed time. Different universe. But my main note of what happens after this is Oh my God, it's that try.
Yes, it's that try.
It starts, the Wallabies have a line out just outside the 22. And Michael Liner again mentions the other bit, one of the two other bits on this game in his autobiography. Mm. He mentions that he was setting up for a drop goal and he wanted the drop goal. And he kind of makes the decision last minute not to call the ball. Okay. But because he notices Eric Champ flying up on him.
Right.
But as that's happening, Nick Farr-Jones is already preparing to pass. So his pass is then off target. And it leads to them kind of, you know, Philippe Seller catching Cody behind the book game line, the ball being spilled, everything then leading to France stealing the ball, leading to this try. Comes from Liner changing his mind last second. And obviously, as we've talked about, scrum after this period, didn't want to be caught in trouble. So no. Nick Farr-Jones throws the pass anyway instead of calling it off and taking contact, which is very understandable when you see this bench pack.
Yeah, yeah. It's a split second decision, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very difficult. Yeah, exactly. And France go absolutely haywire.
Yeah, they do.
It's a very famous attack. I imagine a lot of people listening to this will have probably seen it before. But it all starts, ironically, with Campese getting tackled off the ball by Laurier. And it's just a brilliant piece of shithousery. And then France regather the ball and basically go from one touchline to the other about 9 times before getting tackled. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's very modern. Mm. It's like literally left, right, left, right, left, right, without any plan.
Yeah, and just the offloads all come in until eventually it gets spread from one touchline, as I said, right to the right-hand side, and then back to the other where Lajiske has it, and he just opens up.
God.
Mm. It's that point where he realises, I've got a lot of space outside me. I could do something here. Mm. And you can tell it's all very improvised, but he knows that he's got skillful players all around him and kind of makes it up from there and out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they all did back then, though.
Mm, yes.
That was, if there's one left, one right, we're going.
Yeah, yeah. And he beats that first tackle. And I don't know who it is quite comes up outside him. It might be Barney, I think, the open side.
Yeah, Barney. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Who runs a fantastic support line and kind of identifies that's where the space is. And there's just a split second where he throws an offload. To Champ. And there's the one where Michael Liner goes for the intercept.
Yeah.
And he drops it.
Yeah.
And it's just as he drops that ball, you see on the outside of your frame, Serge Blanco coming into the shot.
Yeah.
Blanco's involved moments earlier and almost has a chance. And then kind of gets himself back on the outside.
Double touch. Coach's dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Lacazette picks it up, doesn't he? And pops it on to Garay, who then spots, hold on, something's on here.
Yeah, and as I say, it's the opportune moment for Serge Blanco to run a good support line, right?
Mm.
He pops up on the outside and there's just nobody else who'd want to finish that try because he's fast and he's powerful.
Yeah.
And thankfully, he's only got like 10 metres to go. So, you know, he doesn't require fitness.
Finds himself up against the hooker as well.
Or lung.
Yes. Exactly.
You know what? You're so right, though, because Lajiske wouldn't have finished that. He'd have been bouncing the touch.
Yeah. He would have needed like an exceptional dive to finish.
Yes. But it was Blanco's got a bit of a shoulder.
Yeah.
Because it's Tom Lawton, the hooker, who's corner flagging, who's trying to get across. Like, it is a powerful player.
Does a good job, right?
Yeah,
he does, to be fair to him.
When you watch the TV footage, it doesn't show how good a job he does as well as the kind of famous still photo of him diving and planting the ball, where you can really see him dragging it along.
Yeah,
It's the other thing Michael Liner notes in his autobiography, that he feels that Blanco touches the corner flag before the ball goes down.
Oh, right.
I tell you what, his feet were very close to the touchline too.
Yeah.
Very close to dragging over.
So Liner says, back in 1987, the corner flag was considered to be out. Tommy definitely had most of Blanco in touch before the ball went down, he says. He says it's suspect is the word he uses of that try. Mm,
interesting.
However, I can imagine. Watching it, I think
it's fine.
My instinct is a try. Yeah, and I think it's a glorious, famous... It's one of these tries, as you said, like I've seen a lot. I've seen that try a lot. But I've never appreciated it as I did for watching the 80 minutes prior.
That's it, yeah.
No, for watching.
So I didn't realise it was in this game. You know, that didn't occur to me.
No,
I
didn't either, if I'm honest.
Yeah, and let alone it being the winning try with so much weight on it. In this World Cup, and this is a proper test match between two brilliant teams.
Yeah.
And for that to be the winning thing, like, as soon as he got that down. And also, by the way, as Blanca comes into the shot, you can see Loria lay down, like, face planted on the floor from tackling Campese a minute ago, which is funny. But yeah, as he slams that down and Camberra nails the kick from the touchline, you think, I just thought, like, go on, France, you deserve to win this now. Yeah. Now you've had that moment. It just was whichever team came up with that moment deserves to win the game, and France did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It was beautiful.
Mm. And it's that point. So France regather the kickoff, and they're clearly very anxious about managing the rest of the game. And Manel just tries to pump it downfield as far as possible. Both teams set the line out. Then the referee blows the final whistle. Mm. And it's kind of an anticlimax.
Yes.
For such an amazing game.
Yeah.
Because neither team knew it was finished because of the whole injury time thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
That you probably would have said to the ref, like, how long's left? And he's going, oh, no, probably like a minute. And then they've just pumped it downfield. Yeah. And, yeah, the final whistle comes and it's absolute scenes. Yeah. And it's incredible that France just in complete pure jubilation. And you could see, like, Daniel de Broglie, like, break down of, like, we're going to a World Cup final.
Yeah.
But Bezier as well. And just, like, it's that moment where... We've often had, like, quite bizarre interviews at the end of games and reactions from players after they've beaten a team who is slightly below their level or their standard. But here, it was two completely, purely evenly matched teams coming up against each other. And just, you could tell they finally had that release of, oh my God, we've actually worked hard for this. Mm. You know, we deserve this. And they interview De Broglie after the game. And as we've established, I don't have a very good understanding of French, but I could just tell from his tone of voice that that was the kind of stuff he was saying. Was like, this is a great group and we've done it. You know, we've got to the final against the
The French squad, as it went dark that night, as the kind of, after they went into the dressing room and they came back out when the pitch had emptied, and they all stood in the middle of the pitch and started singing. And they sang a number of their team songs together in the middle of the pitch mark the celebration they were getting to the,
beautiful.
The final.
Yeah.
Just that's beautiful.
Brilliant to see these two teams really tested to their limit. It's a true classic. I'd recommend anybody to go back and watch this game. It's the one game from 1987 where I just think it's as good as Test rugby gets at that time.
Yes, and I think you're right. Yeah.
It's better than a lot of, you know, really good tests these days. That second half in particular is 40 of the best minutes of Test rugby that we could possibly commentate. Yeah, absolutely. On.
That second half looks like modern rugby to a degree.
It does, yeah.
You know, like, it's...
Everything's just adapted to the time rather than being shit, you know?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It's a game that is talked up as one of the best of all time. I genuinely think it does live up to it.
Yeah, you know? I think it does too.
I think it does. I think this,
and I must admit, before I was, when you guys asked me to come on, I didn't think it would be.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when I was started off, I was like, oh God, I've watched so many of these old matches. But it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
The first 20 minutes did, actually.
The first 20 minutes taken.
I don't know whether I could stick watching this. I'm phoning sick. But then, you know.
Send my mum in.
And yeah, send my mother in, exactly. She'd love it. But yeah, the second 40, that's proper rugby.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Fantastic.
And like, Nick Farr-Jones says in the autobiography that the depression was absolute. We knew we'd blown it, that there was nothing to be done. And it apparently took him a long time to get over.
Yeah, and then they lost to Wales.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like, the sheer emotional energy of this must
burn
so
you out,
draining
man.
For Australia, yeah. Whereas Wales get totally. Battered by the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And, like...
Spoilers.
I mentioned in the previous episode. That, as Jiffy said, like, there was that interview with the team, and they said, like, maybe we shouldn't have spent 3 days on the piss before a World Cup semi-final. And then Jiffy said, no, even if the All Blacks spent the full week on the piss, we wouldn't have beaten them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, like...
It wouldn't have made any difference.
No. Yeah. Very different prospect, emotionally... For Australia coming out of this, losing it right at the death in a game they could have won, where they were 9-0 up at the start.
Yeah.
To Wales not having a chance. They're kind of going, all right, should we play this one last game and give it all we've got? You know, they're two very different environments to go into.
And, you know, when you look back at that New Zealand team, you know, even being 10 years old, we were hearing rumours that they were professional then, they were, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, by 1991, England then were... having those rumours, they're getting paid, right? They're training 3 to 4 times a week. So that's when it started, that 87. Then you realise you had to go professional.
Sure, yeah.
To cope.
Yeah. What a game. What a game. Yeah.
Brilliant, fellas. Man. Good World Cup.
Yeah.
You know.
Should we do Man of the Match and Dick of the Day then?
Yes, let's,
God. Man of the Match. I know my Man of the Match is. And yeah, right, I know what it is.
Please.
Go on.
Please.
Kick us off.
You'll think it's Blanco,
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to go Lužička.
Okay.
Oh, good shout.
Okay.
I like it.
Yeah, just because he created a lot of shit in that game.
Good shout, Paul.
So that's what I would say.
I love it. He came up with a game-changing moment, you know, and he was a balanced game opposite a strong back three. Really,
I think so. And also, Michael Leiner wouldn't have been far off.
Yeah.
You know, he was great, you know.
I think he's right there, very close for me, Leiner. And I think if Australia's seen this through, or even if they just held on to it a bit more, they had a bit more control in the second half, because Leiner is so good in that first half.
Yeah, he is.
And then I think the second half, we kind of see more of his running game. We see less the kind of control that he had over it.
Yeah.
And I think overall, if we're balancing the two halves, I think my man of the match is Philippe Seller.
Oh, there we go.
Who I think is excellent. Like every touch of the ball, he is kind of magical. He makes, like, there's a handful of times when he actually defends, you know, like he makes the blocks stuff that's happening. He kind of plays like a, I think he's fantastic.
Another great shout.
I could watch him play for days.
Yeah.
After that alone, Philippe Seller, my
another great shout. Yeah. I've got quite a lot of people written down because I think genuinely, like, if there's not a player in here who has a bad game, like you see the best version of a lot of these players. Like Andrew Slack is one player who said, you know, maybe the best game he's ever played. Mm. As you say, Leiner really established Australia being in the game. I think Schomp was brilliant.
Yes.
I think Blanco, obviously fantastic. I think what the second best player for me on the pitch was Laurier in the second row. I think he was a pure bastard all day.
Yeah.
And really disrupted stuff, took his try well. But my man of the match is Philippe Seller. He's absolutely unbelievable. And as you say, it was his every touch of the ball was impactful in some way. He was so, so smart in the way he played. And there was just a point where I realised not long after his try, like, oh no, he is a baller. Like, he's a world-class player. And it's just, it takes three or four touches in his hands to just turn this game. Unbelievable. Yeah. Dick of the day.
This is very difficult for this.
Right, mine's easy.
Okay, please.
I'm going for that fucking ball boy.
Yes!
Oh, yes!
You're spot on.
There we are.
Oh, man. So you remember when Matt Gitto famously was dropped in 2011 and he said, thank you, linesman, thank you, ball boys, and nobody else?
Yes.
Imagine dropping Matt Gitto.
Yeah, I know.
In 2011.
Yeah.
Like peak Matt Gitto. Imagine dropping Matt Gitto now. Like, he's still doing a job.
Christ.
Too, Michael Leiner would not have been thanking the ball boys in the way Matt Gitto did.
No chance.
That's right. No.
Do you want to go yours, Robbie, or should I go mine next?
Here's the thing, right? Paul makes a very, very good point. It probably does have to be the ball boy.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the French co-commentator who, because we, you know, watch this French commentary.
Yes.
The main commentator who does a lot of French shouting and so on, and like their commentary on the Blanco try is brilliant. I love it. But, right, the French co-coms is constantly guessing who the ball's going to often. So sometimes, like, one commentator would be saying, Mesnil, and then he'll kind of go, like, or Chavez. He'll be kind of guessing who's going to next, or, like, oh, Blanco.
I didn't notice
that. And he'll catch the ball and be like, and ship it on.
Like, someone does a box kick and you just say, Cabezi! In the background.
Especially on kicks, yeah. Like, just before someone catches it, he'll kind of go, like, oh, Cabezi.
That's brilliant.
It was great. I was a big fan of that. Just that kind of in the background. And at times you'd lose track of who was the main commentator.
I had that multiple times, yeah.
That was very good. But here's the thing. I kind of can't move past that Australian ball boy.
No,
I think it's got to be him.
Yeah.
It's got to be him.
You see, I had written down, one man I've written down was Michael Leiner for losing his shorts, right? But I think we kind of undersold it at the time when we mentioned it earlier, but the Pierre Bibezier switch into touch, I think, is a spectacle. So I have to give him Dick of the Day for the fact that he went, like, called for the ball, like, oh yeah, I know where the space is.
Yeah.
No one's marking the touchline, are they?
No one's marking his 5 meter channel.
Yeah, exactly.
Except that ball boy.
If I run down the advertising hoardings, I'll be all right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Pierre Bibezier is my Dick of the Day.
That's really good, because that move that he called midfit, that doesn't exist now.
You wouldn't play again. Yeah,
it's so funny.
I'm going off your left shoulder straight in the touch, all
right? It's the way there's a man like stood right next to the touchline. He tries to take him on the outside.
What are you doing?
If you take him on the outside, you're in row A of the stands.
No, I'm going to switch left straight in the touch. All right, cheers.
So good. I love it.
All right. Thank you
thank you everyone for joining. Paul, thank you. Thank you for the mammoth effort today.
Tell you what, but as soon as you said take a tangent, you said that to the wrong man.
Indeed.
I will talk shit for I'm so sorry. Once I start talking, I can't
It's been a delight. It's been great.
Absolutely loved this, Paul. And I'm really glad we got you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Where can people find you, your stuff? Where can people, if people want to hear more Paul Williams?
If you want to hear more after this, I'd be surprised. But I'm on Twitter at @ThePaulWilliams. And that's about it, really.
For fans of line spacings, please do.
Go on there, fans of line spacing. Yeah, and just more shit than this, really. You've just put up with 2 hours, 40 minutes of crap. If you want 365 days of it, go to my Twitter account.
Couldn't ask for more.
Thank you so much for joining us. Will, thank you as ever.
You're welcome.
Thank you to everyone listening. Please join us next week when we will be joined once again by Ben James from Wales Online to discuss Wales's 49-6 loss to the All Blacks.
Poor Ben. What a
in
poor bastard.
In the semi-final.
God love him. Good luck with that, Ben.
I can't wait. I can't wait. It should be nearly as chaotic as this.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. Cheers for doing it.
Thanks so much, guys.
And thank you to everyone listening. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.